Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992 here from our perch in 2024. I am one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
I am your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, Lil Stevie, the evangelist child. It would be so great if you hosted this show with like a 12-year-old Christian preacher.
Sure, sure.
Didn't know anything about movies. It was just like here to talk about God, which you do normally. I'm here this week.
I talk about Stevie God make all it. The time. All I talk about is religion
he's
on this podcast.
He's a clone of Steve Martin.
With us today is Griffin Newman.
Hello.
He is back to talk about Steve Martin in Leap of Faith. A movie that doesn't really exist.
I would agree. And I even think, like, in theory, the fact that this was adapted into a failed Broadway musical should make it exist more. And even though that didn't work, the fact that it was, like, that this movie was revived and like retrofitted into a new format. And somehow I feel like the Broadway show exists more than the movie does.
We keep running into movies mm-hmm. in 1992 that got turned into Broadway musicals that flopped, and both the movie and the musical don't exist.
Okay, what are the other ones?
Honeymoon in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Saturday Night.
Right.
And there's a couple others, but like Newsies is the one that works. So, and Aladdin, obviously.
And Aladdin,
sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating.
The Honeymoon in Vegas one, when we talked about that, was also done by somebody quite... I mean, Alan Menken did this.
Right.
Yes.
Who did
Jason Robert Brown did both Honeymoon in Vegas and Mr. Saturday Night. I keep wanting to have him on to chat about that. Like, I don't know how I'd get in touch with him. Jason, if you're listening.
I bizarrely have seen none of those shows. And Aladdin is obviously the only one that is still running.
Had extended run.
All the other ones, I feel like... kind of.
Well, Newsies was pretty big.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. You're right. I'm sorry.
But it's worth it. I never saw it.
Newsies made it to 1,000 performances, which is kind of the... I mean, like, obviously you can make your money back elsewhere, but if you make it to 1,000, it's pretty... It's like the 100 episodes of TV. Okay. I think that Newsies made it to 1,001. So...
Newsies also feels like one that will now be performed at schools for the rest of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, my memory... I'm sure you covered all of this in the proper Newsies episode, but my memory is that, like, Disney had their like A-list theatrical productions, which were mostly let's take our biggest undeniable hits and adapt them.
Yep.
And then there was this like demand for Newsies. They sort of let their B team put out like a regional theater version of Newsies.
Yep.
And then that was doing so well that they were like, we concede, I guess we have to put this on Broadway. But it was like a couple years of them being like, this isn't one of our serious stage musicals, right?
Yeah. It's like how the Hunchback of Notre Dame musical has just been running in Berlin for like 20 years. Right. But like every time people are like, this is an amazing show, we need to bring it somewhere other than Berlin, Disney's like, we don't acknowledge that this exists.
But also, but it, I do remember when they announced that and they were like, we're calling our shot. The next big one is Hunchback. James Lapine's coming in. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, this is too weird for us. But it was like announced with the intention of like, this will be our next one that runs for 10 years. Mm-hmm. Newsies that truly felt like they were like,
they were browbeaten into it. Well, we talked about this on the Newsies episode, but like generationally, Newsies feels very sort of in the brains of a generation because it played consistently on Disney Channel or what have you.
It is very much like a Goofy movie.
Sure.
Internally at the company, they were like, this is some weird thing that did okay. Mm-hmm. And they for a long time weren't even denying, but somehow were not registering the passion. Hocus Pocus, same thing.
Sure.
Where in all three cases, I feel like it took too long for Disney to be like, fuck, we should be squeezing this for money.
Yep.
When they're usually so good at that. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting in that list of 1992 musical adaptations, Newsies is the one that succeeds outside of Aladdin, which
is different.
It's a different
clean, normal success, right? Mm-hmm. But Newsies is like the one that succeeds almost in spite of itself.
Yeah.
And the other ones were like, we know you all think it's insane that we're going to do Honeymoon in Vegas on Broadway, but trust us, when you see it, it's going to work. Like top level people attaching to a movie that doesn't really have like a real history or fondness. Totally. Not a musical originally.
Yeah. Did they do Sister Act as a musical?
They did. They did do Sister Act, and that also failed.
I feel like that failed less spectacularly.
That got Tony nominations.
Right.
These others, like Leap of Faith was nominated for Best Musical and nothing else. Right. But like Sister Act got a few nominations.
Sister Act, like I feel like didn't hit break even, but also didn't close so quickly that it was embarrassing.
Yeah.
Leap of Faith was one of those ones where they were just like, I remember the press campaign, the interviews being like, I know you think it's weird that we're doing Leap of Faith on Broadway.
Yeah.
Either you don't remember this movie or it means nothing to you.
And it's like, okay, so this year is the year Alan Menken finally wins his Tony for Newsies.
Sure.
He also did the score for Leap of Faith, and that was like his passion.
Right,
He spent years pushing that up the hill.
The selling point was just like, trust Alan, when you see this, you're going to get it. It's undeniable.
He loves that central character, and I get it. Mm-hmm. That's a music man character.
100%.
You can build a fucking musical around
Jonas
that.
Jonas Nightingale is definitely built in that mold.
What is fascinating to me is I rewatched this with the like, trying to put on the Menken hat.
Yeah, sure. Being
like, what are you clocking in watching this movie that makes you think, I want to rebuild this in a different format, right? And you can kind of see, like, I think this movie is fascinating.
So do I.
You gave me a list of a kind of, like,
potpourri.
Yeah. And I was sort of like, some of these movies I have stronger connections to. I mean, I've gotten to this space now where, like, when I go on other movie podcasts, I try to pick movies that, A, we haven't covered on Blank Check.
Sure.
Which now having done the show for 9 years.
Harder and harder.
A bigger and bigger list of movies we've covered in some way. And then two, I like try to disqualify anything that feels not even inevitable to cover on the show, but like deeply possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So anything that's part of like too much of a career or a franchise, it feels like we could do on Patreon, I try to rule out. So you send me a list of like, well, that eliminates a lot of things.
Yes. One in particular that we talked about.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they're like, it was this odd grouping. And I was like, is there one of these I have like more of a feeling for that I care about more, either like strongly like for or against.
Yep.
And I was like, Leap of Faith, I like don't care about that much, but I am endlessly fascinated by. I had seen before.
I never
really think about a lot.
Yeah. I think about this movie a lot too. Like I had seen it one time when I was like 13.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like it hung with me in a weird way. I'm just looking up the filmography of director Richard Pierce.
It's an interesting filmography.
Yeah.
the only theatrical movie he made after this is A Family Thing, which is the movie where James Earl Jones and Robert Duvall are brothers. And the whole thing was like sold like twins, but it's like a thoughtful drama.
Never saw it. No. I mean, what I think is interesting too about the sister act of it all too is you have sort of this moment where big comedy names are doing overtly religious movies, right?
That's interesting. Yeah.
And I was racking my brain trying to think of the last time that happened.
Adam Sandler's Eight Crazy Nights.
that might very well be it.
Honestly, yeah.
But because now I think that people are very sort of skeptical or just don't want to jump into the whole religious pool. Yes. But both these movies, one I think being, I mean, Sister Act is just financially more successful.
Yeah.
And I think that Whoopi folds better into it.
Every sense.
Yeah. Right.
Like, audiences loved it. Yes. Critics had to be like, we can't deny this. And it was right. a big hit.
Yeah. But it's interesting that, like, this movie that, I mean, notoriously, Michael Keaton was originally cast in it.
Look, a thing I didn't even realize, but makes me want to talk about this more.
Because those are your two guys. I mean, two of your guys, Steve Martin like, and
absolute and Mount Keaton. Rushmore guys. Yeah. And I think another reason I was attracted to talking about this movie is that it feels an interesting prism through which to discuss mm-hmm. Steve Martin's movie career. And specifically his 90s.
Yes.
Where it felt like he was really trying to see if he could redefine himself a little.
Absolutely.
But alternating between that and straight down the middle.
House sitter.
Yeah. And they all worked.
Yeah.
Like anytime he did a normal thing, it worked. Mm-hmm. And weirdly, unlike a lot of these guys who are like, I want to be taken more seriously. I want to move out of my pigeonhole. Yep. When he would go back and do a House Sitter or a Father of the Bride Part 2, you never felt there was like contempt of like, the audiences are making me do this.
Yeah.
It always felt like he respected the broad studio comedies.
Sure.
Especially as he's now like 90s or when he becomes like America's dad.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the wild and crazy guy thing is totally gone.
Absolutely.
And he becomes like he alternates between being sort of this like embodiment of like suburban, like bottled frustration.
Mm-hmm.
And also he's like leaning into the second era of his main comedic persona, which is like, I am now rich out of touch snob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like he's riffing on those two things wildly successfully. Mm-hmm. And then he keeps on doing these weird like dramedies
where
none of them are like, none of them work.
I'm just looking at his filmography.
And none of them, he's like the problem.
No.
But he's also never totally working.
Well, watching this film, this yeah. movie really actually does feel like a fulcrum point for him. Like it really Absolutely. Does feel like where the sort of road diverges
yes.
in terms of. And I guess the question I was asking myself as I was watching this and looking at his filmography, is there a Bill Murray-esque career that Steve Martin didn't get a chance at?
Great tee up. Because I feel like after Lost in Translation comes out, and that became yeah. such a good reference point mm-hmm. for any A-list comedy star wants their Lost in Translation yeah. to redefine themselves in the final act of their career. And I remember people asking him, and his response was always, I tried stuff like that a bunch of times in the 90s, and audiences always rejected it.
Mm-hmm. And he was good.
No, but you know what's funny? Was he was saying it wasn't even like the market rejected it, so they won't let me do it again, or I care enough about success that yeah. I won't keep doing something that fails. Because they said, like, well, do the smaller version. Do the indie version. Find the director who's sort of at the different point in their career. Don't make it, like, the problem with a lot of these movies is they were sold and produced and pushed out at a studio level
right.
with the same energy and money of the Steve Martin mainstream comedies.
Right.
And you had audiences being like, what the fuck is this?
Right.
But his takeaway from it was, I would, like, sit in those screenings and the audience would kind of reject it. Like, they would refuse to take me seriously. Like, he was like, it's not me feeling beaten down by this.
Right.
I, like, watched in real time that I was never able to overcome some type of relationship with the audience. And you watch this stuff, and I think this is kind of the most interesting example of that experimentation.
Yes.
In so many ways. And part of what's interesting about it is the whole, like, evangelist showman part of it mm-hmm. allows him to, in theory, have his cake and eat it too.
Yep.
Do a dramatic performance that also has kind of wild and crazy guy energy and mm-hmm. Steve Martin showboating, which maybe works against him redefining it. I mean, this is all stuff I want to dig into.
I think also, I mean, the Bill Murray comparison, I think people forget too that like the Wes Anderson stuff does tee up Lost
yes.
in Translation, right? Like,
yeah.
it does, you know, Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums both give him an opportunity to show sort of sad sack comedic energy.
That is the thing he absolutely never got, which I do think is the important bridging element, is no one ever gave him the movie, lead or supporting, where it is you are leaning into Sad Clown.
Yep.
It is still a comedy. It is still a comedic performance, but you're taking the sort of subtextual pathos of the guy, which I would argue has always been there.
Mm-hmm.
There is something, I think there's a lot of sadness to Steve Martin.
I agree.
I think there's an interesting amount of anger to Steve Martin.
Yep.
And I think also he is like a deeply serious man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was this event I think about a lot. Because the other thing that's happening in the 90s is he's like, I'm going to like write Picasso at the La Panagile. Like, I'm going to do my projects for no one.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my stuff that is like personal expression. Right. Mm-hmm. And then later he's like, I'm doing my bluegrass album. Like, you know, just like, this isn't comedy. I have to message to people. This isn't comedy. Right. I'm doing a concert. Don't expect me to do comedy songs. You know, like, and he's always done it with this attitude of like, I'm not asking you to take me more seriously now, but almost like messaging, buyer beware.
Right.
This is me doing self-indulgent stuff. I don't want you to show up and be disappointed. And there was this event at the 92nd Street Y maybe about 10 years ago that was like Steve Martin in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it sold out really fast. And it had been advertised as Steve Martin talks about art.
Sure.
And it was maybe some years after Wild and Crazy Guy, his book came out, which is like one of the greatest books ever written on comedy.
Okay.
And was uncharacteristically open in a way that Steve Martin rarely is about his career and his process. And I think people assumed it was going to be more of that. Like, oh, we're not going to see Steve Martin do comedy, but it's going to be Steve Martin doing the hits of his career and his process and whatever.
Sure.
But it was truly Steve Martin talks about what he likes in fine art. Steve Martin talks his art collection, right? And it was like written up in New York outlets that the audience just turned on it so hard. Where like 15 minutes in, he was like, I'm sorry, I feel like you all
hate this.
Yeah. And they were like, it wasn't even that the audience wasn't into it. It's that he started getting so like depressed and sad sacky about like, I shouldn't have done this. If people buy a ticket to me, they expect I'm going to tell jokes and this is on me. I'm sorry, you can all get a refund. Like they were like, the last 40 minutes of it becomes like, I'm sorry, I feel bad that I tried to talk about the stuff I like
care about.
Yeah, and there's none of that like, why won't you let me? What is this gilded cage I'm in? He's never fighting it. He always seems to feel defeated by it, of like, I tried it and no one liked it and I'm sorry for even trying. And he never found, the fulcrum point that allowed the bridge to happen. But you throw out the sort of Bill Murray loss in translation of it all, the one that felt the only time, and there are other elements in his career where like in the 80s, the earliest version of Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick was building for Steve Martin.
Which,
hell yeah.
Right. Incredible.
Yeah.
There are like stories you hear like that where movies that ended up being radically different at some point before he was even trying to test these muscles, a filmmaker, a high level dramatic filmmaker was like, right. But that was more like push him into very different territory.
What if after House Sitter, Eyes Wide Shut had been when Martin and Han like reunited?
Yes.
By the way. Great.
Yes.
Martin, Han, Kubrick.
Yeah. The one that on paper felt like that could have been the one that worked for him.
Yeah.
Is I remember when, Jason Reitman was promoting Up in the Air.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, so you wrote this for Clooney, right? Like, what were you going to do if Clooney didn't do this? And he said, George was absolutely, like, I wrote this for Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
My only backup option I had if Clooney rejected it was I was going to dramatically rewrite the script for Steve Martin.
Which I could see.
Yeah.
That would have worked.
And he was like, two versions of it. I wouldn't have just slotted him into this. It would have been very different with this guy at a different stage in his life. But that was the one version. And you're like, that's a piece of material you could see.
I could see him doing that.
Where he gets like jokes and he's funny, but it's speaking to an essential loneliness.
Yeah.
I do wonder about Parenthood.
I love Parenthood.
Like that is a more sitcom-y movie than like a like a Rushmore or something. But it felt like him figuring out Robin Williams mode. And it feels like what he took from it was, I'm just going to play a dad a bunch.
Yes. Right. Because it's like, I can still be funny, but not as the silly, ridiculous guy anymore. Rewatching Parenthood recently, like last week, it is so much more sitcom-y than I remembered it being. Mm-hmm. The thing I had completely forgotten is how many like fantasy sequences it has where he gets to do basically sketch comedy.
Yeah.
Which I think really sold the balance for audiences of like, I'm not just seeing Steve Martin in button down mode.
Sure. It also, I mean, that movie is also kind of a turning point for Ron Howard as well. Like, yeah. It feels like it's, I think Parenthood's a legitimately underrated movie. I think it's doing a lot of things really well. Yeah. The movie that I was thinking about was Shop Girl, mm-hmm. which I have my issues with because yeah. I think that that movie doesn't age particularly well.
I haven't watched it in a while.
Yeah. But it is kind of a, first of all, it's an interesting cast. I mean, Schwartzman, Claire Danes, and Steve Martin are it's just kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
The book, which I never read, that Steve Martin wrote.
Read the book.
And then he adapted himself. Yes. Is a little bit sort of old man falls in love with young shop girl. I mean, but he's good in it. And it's got like juice in it.
That book, I remember reading it when it came out and being like, oh, this is about him and his now wife. Mm. This is clearly autobiographical. Okay. And is kind of like in that way textually about, it almost feels like it's him writing a book to litigate, am I a creep? Like, have I become a cliche of myself? The rich old man who like woos some like pretty girl behind a counter. And the love triangle of that movie is like, should she be with the guy her own age? But the guy her own age
kind of sucks.
Yeah. And he's like sort of going like, I feel guilty that I've become the cliche of the guy, but also I understand why a woman would rather be with the man who not just has the resources, but like kind of has his life together, but also is more sad sacky than this young guy with energy. And then him making the movie and casting himself in that part makes it very fascinating. Because I do think he's quite good in that movie.
I do too.
And I think it's a very revealing performance.
Yeah.
I think it's his best quote-unquote dramatic performance. I think it's the best he's ever worked in that vein.
Yeah.
But it really feels like that's him totally naked.
Another movie that doesn't exist.
The thing that Robin Williams, Jim Carrey, Bill Murray all did was turn themselves over to directors.
Yes.
And every time Martin wants to like break out of his, he's writing it. And I think that I love L.A. Story. I've never revisited it. I don't want to because I think it's probably aged weirdly.
Yeah.
But he does Grand Canyon and he does Mixed Nuts. And those two are like him trying to work with like an interesting director. And it just doesn't land. And then this is like sandwiched between them is him like he turns himself over to this Richard Pierce. So why not?
Well, and then there's what's it called? Simple Twist of Fate, which is the Silas Marner.
Correct.
Marner's wrote. Remake of Silas Marner.
Like all these things, most of them you're right, kind of steering in some way.
Yeah.
Where he's like writing or it feels like he was the main force kind of putting it together. But a lot of them are these kind of journeyman directors. And then when he would hand himself off over to someone who had sort of more bona fide chops, they maybe weren't pushing him the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, like Spanish Prisoner is an interesting movie, the David Mamet movie, and he's quite good in it, but again, playing totally serious.
That is the example he always cites as that was the moment where I decided I'm never going to try to do this ever again.
Oh, okay.
Where he said, you know, like, fucking David Mamet's my friend. I was so honored he asked me to do it. Right. I thought it was an interesting character. I go to the test screenings. I come on screen. The audience starts laughing, and I immediately felt bad.
Yeah,
for the movie that I had ruined it.
I
think he's too hard on himself about that.
I do too.
And I think he's good in Spanish Prisoner.
Same.
But he was just like, I don't want to ruin anyone else's material by basically, in his mind, creating the 92nd Street Y dynamic where audiences feel like they've been sold a false bill of goods.
Yeah. I think he's in a place right now where he could... Oh, I think only murders... in the building. Yeah. I'm not like that. That show has its ups and downs, but like it feels like it has given people a renewed appreciation of him.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
And also he gets to play a little bit more dramatic and romantic on the show than he normally does. And I wonder if like he could translate that into something with like, I don't know. I feel like he'd be really good with Celine Song for some reason. I just feel why not?
Sure,
that. Do something a little bit. I think he's good when he's a little bit wistful.
Yes.
I think he's, I mean, part of the weirdness of him in the late 90s, obviously he thought Mixed Nuts was going to be, I mean, it was Nora Ephron, and I'm sure that everybody thought that that was going to work.
Remind me, does Leap of Faith come out before or after Mixed Nuts?
Before. Mm-hmm. And this is 92, Mixed Nuts is 94.
Okay.
And then Sergeant Bilko.
Fascinating that they are his two dyed hair comedies.
Correct.
I was trying to place, were they shot back to back? Did he dye for one, hold it over for the other? But that's another thing where dyed hair, this comes out, flops. First time there's a Steve Martin poster where he doesn't have white or gray hair.
Yeah.
And then Mixed Nuts pointedly puts a Santa Claus hat on him.
Yeah.
Where on the poster.
Yeah.
Where it feels like they were hiding. Audiences don't like him with dyed hair.
This also, the hair in this is just a strange shade too. Fair. It's not, it's like they don't want to go full too dark, but they don't want to, it doesn't.
And I get that they probably were like, well, this guy would have a sort of bad artificial dye job.
Sure.
But I'm also like, this guy with white hair
makes more sense.
Probably holds more weight on stage.
No, absolutely.
They're like all the guys they're riffing on had bright shock white
That's
hair.
The thing.
Like the most obvious analog for Jonas Nightingale is this faith healer on television called Benny Hinn, who has this like really tall pompadour that's like just shock white. Mm. And like, I'm guessing they took a lot of the techniques that he used to like seem like he was healing people. Ricky Jay, who's one of my, I'm sure. huge, like Ricky Jay is like one of the people I love most in all of reality.
One of the greatest human beings to ever live.
Absolutely. And like he did a lot of the consulting here, and it does feel like they're drawing from, like you read about how Benny Hinn was finally exposed, and it's like a lot of the stuff in this movie.
Yeah, by the way, is the other reason I wanted to cover this movie on this podcast, is I'm very interested to hear your perspective on a lot of this.
I very much want to hear Emily.
Both as someone with a religious background, also I feel like you were one of the only people I know who like actually interrogates religious films on an analytical level and has tried to sell me on the value of watching some of them sometimes.
Sure, sure.
Where like the discourse around those movies, which have become increasingly a huge subgenre and basically a giant industry in and of itself, are either like, well, the people who love them are dyed in the wool and have like are applying no critical facilities to this whatever faculties. They're just blindly going to see whatever, like it's a faith healer in a tent or whatever, or people just dismiss them out of hand. Yeah. And you like really like dig into like, this is weird. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Before we do that though, can I do a little bit of context before we dive into that?
Phil, read your thing. Let's do it.
Because my fear is that people don't know what the fuck we're talking about because a lot of people have not seen this movie.
They haven't?
Yeah, I know. Touring Christian evangelist Jonas Nightingale, played by Steve Martin and his cohorts, tend to their bogus faith healing revivals in major cities where hefty donations flow freely. But when Jonas and company find themselves stuck in a remote nook of Kansas, they decide to perform for the locals and take them for all their worth. The show goes off without a hitch until sensible lawman Will Braverman, played of course by Liam Neeson, catches onto the scam and vows to prove to everyone that Jonas is a fake. Leap of Faith opened on December 18th, 1992, and let's do just a very brief box office game.
Okay. Because I will say, I know this movie bombed because for so long, even as like a diehard Steve Martin kid, my only association with this movie was the David Spade Weekend Update bit.
Oh, I don't know that.
They showed the poster for the movie.
Sure. With him in the mirrored, correct, mirrored blazer.
And he went, oh, look, children, it's a falling star. Oh. And I think he had similarly done a bit like that for one of Eddie Murphy's flops around the same time.
Which is in the...
Distinguished in the Gentleman.
Yeah, that's in the top five.
Okay.
A movie that also doesn't exist.
So I think he did that bit first, and Eddie Murphy got publicly really angry, and that's when he was like, I'm never fucking going back on SNL ever again, a thing he held on to for 20 years. Where he was like, I saved the show.
Yeah.
How dare you fucking attack me? So then I think when Spade makes the similar joke, or might have done the exact same wording with Steve Martin, it's like a callback. But the bit is Steve Martin comes on,
okay,
walks behind David Spade,
and
is like, get out of the chair, and then sits down and starts attacking David Spade's career in the same way. And there was something about like, oh, I'm watching this years later,
right?
And I'm like, that must have been such a big bomb for Steve Martin to come on and immediately be like, I need to dunk on this movie myself. To reclaim the narrative. I need to sit behind the desk and be like, that's a mistake, I'm sorry.
I mean, because the thing is, he has House Sitter, which comes out earlier in the year, which which does well. It does fine. He's still Steve Martin. Like, but this movie, which comes out in December, which means that perhaps they had Oscar potential.
I don't know.
Did they think, like, Steve Martin maybe gets... anyway.
I wonder if they were doing it for that religious crowd. You know?
Oh, Christmas.
Like Sister Act is kind of leaving theaters, and that crowd maybe wants to watch something. But yeah.
Because you posted, Phil, the teaser poster for this movie, which is insane. This movie had a like multi-tiered poster rollout.
That was what I thought. I'm just like, this isn't Batman.
No. But that poster very much has like this holiday season energy.
Yeah. It has very similar to Unforgiven, which has an amazing – one of the best teaser posters, which is just the back of Clinton. It just says Unforgiven and the date. Yeah. Kind of has the same energy where they're like Steve Martin and Jesus.
And it that poster makes it look like a straight up supernatural comedy.
It does.
It makes it look like Witches of Eastwick or something.
Absolutely.
It looks like Bruce Almighty.
Yeah. He's got – he's holding a cloud with lightning in his hand.
And it makes you think like – it's got this energy of like wait until you meet this guy. And I'm like I can't even imagine what this guy's going to be like. And then you're like just kind of like an angry con artist.
Number one at the box office. This opens. Yeah, it's not even in the top five.
Insane.
The first is a sequel to a holiday movie that everybody loves.
Home Alone 2,
Lost in New York. The second movie comes from one of your favorite comedy troupes. Also a Christmas movie.
My favorite comedy troupe.
Yes, they what's the best way to describe this comedy troupe, Emily?
I think I know what you're going for. And
when
I
you say troupe, I mean like not like
it's a group of characters.
They've performed together for a long time.
They've performed on television together for a long time,
for decades.
Mostly for children.
Yeah,
aimed at children primarily.
It's a Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah, that's what I guess.
Troupe is that's a clever way of wording.
Distinguished Gentleman is the next one. Then we have one of the Best Picture nominees from 1992, from a filmmaker who never got a Best Director nomination. Oh,
wow. Never. Is it Few Good Men?
It is a Few Good Men.
Yeah.
And then the last one
This is not all opening. This is just top five of that weekend.
Yeah.
The last one is the second highest grossing film, or maybe the first highest grossing film of 1992, a colossal romantic drama.
Ghost? No, that's
not here.
Yeah.
It's got an enormous soundtrack.
Oh.
It's not The Bodyguard?
It is The Bodyguard.
It is The Bodyguard. Okay.
Which you alluded to when you guys did A Star Is Born as sort of maybe that's why we didn't get
one in the 90s.
I think tracks. This movie makes $23 million on a $20 million budget.
I mean, honestly, that is more than I thought it made.
Yeah.
I looked up its box office run, and it went up a little bit in week two.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then it fell just a very little bit in week. And granted, it's a holiday season, but
like not a success by any metric.
No
cultural permanence.
Nope.
But I would have believed this movie made like $4 million if you told me like this was just absolute.
64% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics. Yeah. So like it didn't, 46 from audiences. So like people that saw it didn't like it.
Like just whatever.
Rodriguez gives it 3 stars. He quite liked it. He praises Steve Martin's, you know, performance in it, which I think a lot of people did. Janet Maslin did the same thing, said well acted, you know, all that. So it's one of those movies that I feel like if critics just got on board with it a little bit more, it probably could have led to other things.
It is a movie, but I almost think it would be insincere for any critic to get more on board with this movie. I'm not questioning, like, you know, the taste of individuals, right? If you think this movie is a masterpiece, God be with you, right? Like, I think this is one of those weird movies where I'm like, it is kind of simultaneously neither good nor bad.
I was on board with this movie more than I expected to be kind of at all, and pretty early on.
I think this movie is like almost catastrophically organized on a narrative level.
Yeah.
But the pieces of it are so good.
And the cast is
Is so good where you'll be watching it and you'll be like, fuck, this should rule.
Yes.
I should be so on board with it that it's like you want to grade it on the curve of like, God, the thing it's trying to do, I like so much.
Totally.
And at times it hits it. So, I get giving it a gentleman's 3 out of 4 stars.
Sure, sure.
And I also could just imagine people being like, not funny, but also not emotional.
Yeah, it's the Richard Pierce
neither
component.
Fish nor fowl.
Is the problem, I think.
Yeah, the weird thing is this movie needs Ron Howard. Like, not a director where I'm like, put him in. But, like, it needs that guy who's good with ensembles, who's like good at like pulling out the end. Like this movie needs to be the paper.
Or it would also have demanded a rewrite of some sort or like given notes so that it actually has a third act that works.
Well, I don't know. It's crazy because the last 20 minutes of this movie feel like they should happen at the halfway point.
Yes.
There are 15 things of major significance that happen in the last 15 minutes of this movie where like truly like at hour 30, you're like this. You're doing this now.
Yeah, yeah.
How
the rain isn't the end of the second act is crazy.
I think that's a great ending. I think that the rain as the end of the movie is
really
perfect.
I kind of agree with that. I think Lucas Haas should be the midpoint.
Oh, yes, that's absolutely.
Yes.
That is the midpoint of the movie.
Yeah.
It's crazy that that and the rain and the people being camped outside, like all of that stacked up as like basically three beats of the same idea all at once, very late. Yeah. Is wild to me, but I can see someone like Alan Menken, especially if he has an interest on this type of character, being like, fuck, all the pieces are there. And I feel like, Emily, you went deeper into the musical play than I did. Am I wrong in my understanding is that the play basically combines the Lolita Davidovich character with the Liam Neeson character?
And when they did it in L.A., they were two separate characters still.
Right.
Then when it went to Broadway, they were like, we're going to make this one lady sheriff and Jonas is going to fall for her. They basically just did the Music Man, Marion.
Which makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. Because when you're watching this, it's so wild. My memory of watching this, I watched this for the first time after Philip Seymour Hoffman died.
Oh.
Because I was like, you know what? I want to fill all my gaps.
Sure. I mean, he's barely in this.
He is. And it, like a lot of the gaps I was filling were like his early ensemble work.
Sure.
Where you're like, he's all over this movie and doesn't really do anything.
Yeah.
But it's fast. Like this is in his sort of like twister bucket.
I think there's more of him on the editing room floor is my guess. Because he's cast pretty high up for all intents and purposes. And this is the same year as Son of a Woman.
Yeah.
So, which
but also like Meatloaf is fourth billed in this movie and he maybe has five lines.
Yeah. Yes. Like, it's crazy.
You can see how all these guys were doing a lot.
Yes. And then just the characters were gutted.
Because this movie has like fucking 5,000 plot lines. And it doesn't really, like, it isn't set up in a way where you actually have scenes that are built to let the ensemble shine outside of them just cheering for what he's doing.
Yay. Yeah. The crew, if you will, of his con gets short shrift because it feels like the Deborah Winger, Liam Neeson stuff, in whether on script or in editing, becomes a lot more substantial.
Well, so I'm watching this after Hoffman dies, but I'm not expecting a lot of Hoffman. I'm mostly watching this as like, this is a good excuse to now see one of the Steve Martin movies I haven't seen.
Yeah.
And my memory, having watched this 10 years ago or whatever, was like, oh, weirdly, Steve Martin's not really the lead of that movie. It's more of a Deborah Winger, Liam Neeson film.
It is.
And he's kind of almost the Beetlejuice character, the biggest character. Yeah. And then rewatching it, there was less of the Deborah Winger, Neeson than I remember.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's kind of the weirdest amount it could be as a split.
It's the thing, like, my quick and easy fix to make this a movie that makes sense is to flip it so Deborah Winger's the lead and Steve Martin is the, like, supporting. We're going to push him for the
Oscar.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
This movie doesn't really work with him being the center of the story because part of it is, like, I don't know how to fucking read this guy.
Yeah. Well, it's that and it's also the romance with Lolita Davidovich doesn't go anywhere.
No.
Now, I don't know if that was just they didn't have much chemistry and they just figured like, we don't really need this character. So she's kind of gutted.
Yes.
There's that. But then there's also the fact that to your point, he's a very enigmatic character and which is interesting.
Yeah.
The only thing we learn about him is that he was abandoned by his mother.
Right.
And that fucked him up.
You learn that very late
from
Deborah Winger.
Correct.
Like he's never.
And the closest he comes is this.
His final scene with Lucas Haas.
Yeah.
Which comes at the very end.
Well, and then the moment with Lolita Davidovich, which is kind of sweaty, where he's sort of like, tell him if he's waiting on this. It's all kind of like weird, like, mirror stuff.
I think part of the problem is he's 16 years older than Lolita Davidovich. And he feels 25 years older than her. It feels like he's trying to date like an 18-year-old.
I agree.
But also you're like, this movie sets up two romances between the traveling hucksters and the local townspeople who are like, look, these other rubes might fall for your stuff, but please don't hurt these people.
The other thing that the play does that Emily mentioned, which I think is also really smart, is that the Deborah Winger character is his sister. They needed to do that as well.
It makes so much sense. And Deborah Winger is weirdly overqualified for this role.
Yes.
And not just overqualified, but it's like her being in it unbalances the movie.
She's really good. Better than the movie deserves.
Like, she needs to kind of be the co-lead.
But
she's just, within the main narrative, just the supportive sounding board. Mm-hmm. The one who knows him best, but without the weird. You need something like the sister where it's just like the history is baked in and all of that.
Yeah.
But also it's like, It makes so much sense to gender flip the sheriff and have it be the person who's trying to bust him in the relationship. Because the niece and Winger scenes are interesting on the level of, like, he hates everything she's doing, but also is falling for her.
Yeah.
But he's able to absolve her of some of the responsibility because she's not leading it. Whereas Leah Davidovich has the same view as Steve Martin, but she also doesn't have the power within the town to do anything the way the Neeson character does. You're like, that's one fucking plot line, and that's the center of the movie emotionally.
It's very strange. Emily, I'd like to dive into the religious component of this, and then we'll talk about the
Oh, it's also romance. Very strange. Actually, like, I was trying to be like, this movie made more money than I thought it did.
Yeah.
And I was like looking for the sort of groundswell, and I started reading Christian movie review blogs, and they all like this movie. So I wouldn't say they love it.
Did they kind of support keep it afloat after it started?
I wonder if they did. Like, this does feel like, I remember the Nora Ephron movie Michael came out, and a lot of those church groups went to see that, and then they all walked away and were like, what a terrible movie. That just blasphemed.
That was sacrilegious.
Our Lord and Savior. Yeah. And like, this movie doesn't, because this movie ends on the rain and ends on, a lot of them misread it as, you know, in the movie it's explained as Lucas Haas's thing is psychosomatic. So like, he kind of overcomes his mental block. And like, a lot of them have been like, well, now Jesus, of course, has made this boy walk, could not walk before. And also he brought the rain. And the movie, I think, does the rain especially, the movie does the very smart Damon Lindelof thing of there's 20 plausible explanations for this and there's one religious explanation, but you really want that religious one to be true. And like, I think that is a smart call it makes, but it also like made Christians be like, this movie acknowledges that God exists and controls everything and we should applaud it for that, even though it has some, I'm quoting the review, rough language.
But there's also,
it does end with him screaming, thank you, Jesus.
Yeah.
if you were watching this movie as like a dyed-in-the-wool evangelical,
there
is a read on this film that is like, this is the kind of guy that we all are worried about, is like taking us for a ride.
Yeah.
We want to believe guys like this are real, but society is often telling us that they're con artists who are taking advantage of us. And this is a movie in which that guy is challenged and realizes what he thinks is full of shit is real, and he's actually that powerful.
Yeah. The unique thing about this is it comes at a point in time when evangelicals are interested in hearing that because there have been all of the televangelist scandals of the late 80s.
Right. All these guys are being busted.
And so like, they're like, okay, well, we want to see about this guy, you know, and like, then he has like a real religious experience. They're grafting onto it a narrative that doesn't really exist within the film, but that feels like a movie.
But this movie, that you can read it as saying like, this movie is simultaneously saying, yes, we know most of these guys are fake, but also God is real and miracles happen.
Yeah.
Which is like a pretty convenient way to process the world if you've now got caught up in several of these scandals with which guys you bought as like false prophets.
This is like, you see why Alan Menken looked at this and said, this is The Music Man, because it's like all right there. Yeah. And he could never quite solve it. I think the other solve I would do is make his antagonist like a minister, like that he starts to fall for. Like, I think the musical introduces kind of a counterpoint storyline about like a black family that's very religious. And it's one of the early roles for Leslie Odom Jr. And like, you can see where like that all kind of would click. His songs on the soundtrack are amazing. The thing about that this movie gets dead wrong about evangelicalism is that it has a crucifix. And the evangelical tradition has empty cross, because the idea is that Jesus is, we're not like Catholicism. It makes sense if you're making a movie that you want to reach a mass audience, because Catholicism is the church that most people know, and that has a crucifix. But it is totally unrealistic that there would be one there. CinemaSins counter goes up to 48. Like, that's
really
seriously. Like, the fact that there's a crucifix in this immediately pinged me as like, oh, this is made by people who don't know what they're doing.
Interesting.
Yeah,
but is the crucifix there only for ultimately plot purposes, which is two-thirds of the way through the film, he fakes that the crucifix opens his eyes.
I think that it is there.
Yes.
I think that it is there because they need a representation of Jesus, and that's the easiest way to get one. I think there's a ton of plot reasons you do that. I don't necessarily think they didn't know what they were doing, but that's like my deep dyed 6-year-old evangelical Christian self was like wrong.
If they pass you this script, the first note you have is you have to change what the visual miracle is.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
It's face of Jesus on the side of a barn, it's whatever it is, right?
A lot of times there would be like a bleeding cross,
sure.
So it's like an empty cross, but like blood is dripping down. Like that's an easy thing you could do.
But like a lot of ways to achieve the same plot function without. I mean, I never would have pinged that ever. That's interesting.
That's why I'm on the show.
Yeah, I mean, but I do think, though, and I'm curious, Emily, because you obviously know more about this than I do, but at this point, there's a fair amount of people being outed, if you will, in terms of being hucksters and conners, what have you. Yeah. And a lot of it stems from the technological advancements that are going on, right? So you have this kind of, which I didn't know, but this whole like tech version of Deborah Winger's guy in the van element, right? Where she's looking at all these different camera angles and they're able to, you know, earpieces and what have you. Was that part of, like, was there a sort of surgence of these conners because of the technology?
I think there's always been these cons. And I think the first scene of this movie made me think I was going to love it when they get pulled over by the cop. Yes. And Steve Martin just kind of like guts his way through conning this guy. And
so
like
so many scenes where you're just like, I think this is a masterpiece. Yeah. So, I want to go to the mat for this so hard.
Yeah. So like the faith healing stuff and the like, I'm going to like, God is giving me, it's just traditional confidence games. Like they've been around forever, but yes, the tech aspect adds something to it. What's interesting about this is that like a lot of the televangelists who fall because they cheat on their wives,
right?
You know, they have relationships with prostitutes or something like that. Yeah. Sex workers. I always correct myself, but they
fall prey to classic rookie moves.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like there's some of them are caught with young men and it's like, oh, well, this guy who was in my house naked is I wasn't sleeping with him. He was just wandering around my house naked, you know?
And you're right that usually like that is the catalyst that then causes a larger investigation into their thing, which then reveals the sort of like financial scheme.
I like, there's two really great novels written by ex-evangelical people, Kelsey McKinney's God Spare the Girls, which is like about a evangelist followed by a sex scandal. And the other one, it's called Miracle Season. I don't remember the author, but it is about a evangelist fallen by a faith healing scandal. And like, those are kind of the two things when we were all coming of age that was like in the culture.
But you have these 1-2 punches of like, A, we're finding out they're hypocrites.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And B, we're finding out that they've built this pyramid scheme with our money.
Yeah.
Right.
This particular script was apparently loosely based on this Peter Popoff person. I don't know if you know who this person is. No. So a televangelist who performed a similar trick with his wife at a microphone. Mm-hmm. And his career took a nosedive when he was publicly outed on the Johnny Carson show by a professional magician and skeptic who managed to smuggle a radio scanner into one of the revival things.
Oh, right. I've heard about this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was sort of where this loosely comes from.
Was that the amazing Randy? What's his name?
Yeah, James Randi.
And it's like, that's the thing about the monoculture. We talk about the monoculture a lot on this show. You could expose a charlatan, and now you can't. You just can't.
It is just fascinating to me that this sort of this confluence of technology and religion at this moment.
I think there's another thing you have to add into the soup, which is cable TV.
Yes.
Sure.
I think certainly like the stagecraft technology makes it a lot easier for people to put on these shows and make them even more explosively impressive to craft greater miracles. But the other thing is like cable TV suddenly means you have all these channels that are like, we only have 12 hours of programming a day. Mm-hmm. Here's like paid advertising. Here's a block that runs at odd hours.
Especially these people, right?
Right. Or they're starting their own channels.
Yep.
So these guys are just like, they suddenly have a much greater communication device than they've ever had, which makes it fascinating that like, it does feel like this movie is about the 70s version of this guy.
Yes.
Aside from the pyrotechnics of the show itself,
yeah,
the weird like hippie bus traveling circus element of it, you're like, this guy would be trying to do it on a bigger scale.
You set this, that opening scene on TV. You set it in like, he pulls somebody out of the crowd and he cons them in front of everyone. It's on TBN or one of those channels. And then he goes on the road and his bus breaks down somewhere. Like that gets you, then everyone knows who he is. Yeah, and like, this, it's a very weird.
Yeah, no one knows who this guy is.
He comes out of nowhere.
I mean, which is very Music Man. I mean.
Yeah, but he's got that sort of like old school con artist thing where it's like, you keep a low profile so the stories don't travel from town to town.
Sure, sure, sure.
Whereas this type of guy at this point is telegraphing himself as loudly and as frequently as possible. And there's a certain hubris and arrogance to these guys of like, nothing's fucking taking me down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't need to hide. I don't need to like, I'm advertising.
Yeah.
It's national.
This is around the time of Tammy Faye as well, right?
Tammy Faye's about 6-7 years earlier.
Oh, okay.
That's the first big one to really break. Jim Baker is like, he goes on TV and is like, I have failed my God, I failed my wife, and it's tears
but
streaming.
This is a movie that feels like it kind of doesn't
acknowledge that. Yeah.
It is not a movie that takes place in the wake of a cultural moment that big.
At all.
Let alone the other scandals of that ilk that happened in the ensuing years.
I totally agree. We mentioned this earlier, but what would you think of Michael Keaton in this role?
Yes. So I think Martin's good in this.
Yeah.
I think he's most interesting in the scenes, like you were saying, Emily, the sort of like him trying to get his way out of the parking ticket, playing basketball against the guys.
Sure.
Sort of like using theatrics to try to like win a date with Lita Davidovich.
Uh-huh.
That stuff, he's like doing these sort of small cons almost like spitefully and for sport.
Yeah.
There is an anger there that's really fascinating. And I feel like you don't often see with Steve Martin. I feel like he will play anger that comes out of extreme frustration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the angriest he usually gets in a movie is like the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles scene that immediately corrects him as like, this guy was an asshole and he needs to learn to care.
Right.
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 There's that kind of thing. I can't believe my daughter's having a baby, sort of stuff. You know, everyone's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
Queen Latifah's bringing down the house. Like, that's the mode of anger that we're used to for him. And this is like a quiet sort of like disdain and contempt for everyone around him is an idiot. And I even think he views the rest of the bus as like, they're my allies, but they're not next level operators the way I am, save for Deborah Winger.
I agree.
It is his backstory, you know, falling into the Child Protective Services, child welfare.
Right.
Like a lot of that was run by churches when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't like the thing you find out when you're a Christian kid who doesn't quite believe everything is that you quickly figure out how to lie. And you quickly figure out, I mean, this is every religion, but like Christianity is what I'm familiar with.
But this guy has like a well-earned cynicism that he feels has been supported by the world. And he's got that attitude that a lot of these guys have of like, I'm not an asshole, I'm just smart. Right? It's the Trump like, I don't pay my taxes because I'm smart.
Yeah.
You're an idiot if you fucking play by those rules.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the only way to survive.
Which is why Lucas Haas should be the midpoint. Correct. And the end should be him seeing like this rain, which is possibly a miracle.
He should be having the crisis of faith for the entire second half of the movie
of
being angry that anything good is happening because of him, questioning whether he has any actual power, if it's coincidence, whatever. But I do think when you get to the actual performances of this movie, and one of the things that makes this movie interesting, but I also think is fundamentally kind of fucked in how it's built, is it almost is structured like a concert tour documentary where you're like fully 40% of this movie is maybe on stage performance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff outside of that is the kind of classic tour documentary cutaway to show you the crew, what he does in the off days.
Totally.
He goes to the local diner, meets fans kind of stuff. But it doesn't have like narrative build. And then they'll cut away to the Deborah Winger, Liam Neeson. And you're like, I think that's why in my mind I remembered that being the A-plot. Because I'm like, it's the only story that like progresses naturally.
Yeah. I mean, so much of this is in the tent.
Yes.
I mean, so much of it.
So much. And on one hand, you're like, well, great to have Steve Martin do this. Yeah. This guy hasn't done stand-up in fucking 15 years, but we want to see him just cut loose on stage. The problem is, I do think he, in those performances, as captivating as he is, you just fucking love to see Steve Martin on stage wearing silly suits.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like, this is a thing we all fucking eat up for 15 years, right? He has a hard time, I think, not falling into his 70s stand-up persona in those routines, which was a doofus. Like that character, his stand-up character was hyper-confident doofus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a silliness to the way he performs it that is undoubtedly engaging. You don't question he would get an audience, but the real versions of these guys are so self-serious and self-righteous and dramatic about it, where their sort of theatricality and pomp and circumstance is not the kind of showmanship that he's doing, which is much more Harold Hill. Michael Keaton, I think, would have been a little more dangerous on stage.
Yeah.
That's the big difference, is I think he would have had a little more menace
Yeah.
and a little more of that kind of like insipid Because when Steve Martin's doing his routines in this, I'm like, he's not performing like he believes what he's saying. He's doing it in quotes.
Yep.
He's doing it like the character is so insincere that he can't even feign giving a shit. It's just like song and dance. Versus Michael Keaton would have like committed really hard in a way that would have made him scary.
I think that Michael Keaton, I mean, you put it perfectly, like there is more danger to Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton has played dramatic roles and sort of, you know, villainous type things. He can pull that off.
Right. A lot of his like Beetlejuice is a dangerous comedy character. He's a genuine menace. Yeah. I won't say his name again. like his Batman, it's the reason his Batman remains so interesting.
Yeah.
Of you're just like, is this guy insane?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that he is attached to this.
Yeah.
For a while, he pulls out and Steve Martin, you know, jumps in, I think, after a couple of weeks. So I do wonder what it was, perhaps the things we're bringing up for Michael Keaton that made him go like, this isn't there yet.
This is senior as Batman Returns.
Correct.
And basically he has like the rest of his 90s are rough, which isn't to say he doesn't do good work or he's in a couple good movies. But like his movie star career.
Correct.
His status as a leading man, he like basically the second he leaves Batman, it's totally thrown off axis.
Can we talk about Jack Frost for a little bit?
Sure. Because
I watched that this holiday season. I was watching.
Emily loves Christmas.
I love Christmas. I watched Fred Claus for a different podcast.
I watched Fred Claus for the first time. That movie is insane.
Completely insane. And Hulu was like, Hulu was like, I'm just going to start playing Jack Frost for you, Emily. I know what you want. And I was like, I'm going to watch this. And there's a magic harmonica. There's the snowman. I mean, everyone has said this, but the snowman really does look like Clooney. It's, it is a movie about a dad who is brought back from the dead by a magic harmonica because he promised not to let his kids down. But it does like honor that at the end he just dies again. It's got some of the worst CGI you've ever seen. Phil, you got
to
watch
it. Was it supposed to be a horror movie? Was that? Is there some?
No. There is the other Jack Frost horror movie.
Okay, that's what I was saying. Okay.
Which there is an urban legend that they started as the same project and split off. But the Clooney thing's 100% true.
Yeah. So Clooney just bailed on it.
Yes. It was, I think, originally going to be called Frosty the Snowman and was built around Clooney. Mm. Then they started moving it away from Frosty, but still Clooney. Clooney drops out late enough that the animatronic was done.
It's wild because it is plausibly just a snowman. But once you know it was supposed to be Clooney, you're like, yeah, that's George Clooney.
And that's like at the nadir of Michael Keaton leading man before he kind of goes in the wilderness for a couple of years.
What brings him back? Because now I'm just like,
he has a couple of false starts at coming back.
Okay.
Like he'll like do like whatever it is, like 7 years later.
I mean, Jackie Brown
is same year as
Out of Sight. 97, 98 is when he has those two smaller roles.
I think Jack Frost is 98.
Jack Frost is 98.
Right. Like Jack Frost is kind of the capper on that. And then he'll like come back and do something like White Noise, which was like a hit, but everyone was like, this is kind of depressing that you're in a January horror movie.
He's in the RoboCop remake. I mean, it's Birdman. It really is Birdman.
Yes.
He's in Herbie Fully Loaded. Let's not forget.
Herbie was Fully Loaded.
Like when I saw Other Guys, I was like, he's back. Now everyone's going to hire him to do this again. And it didn't happen, even though that movie was a hit.
Yeah.
And he's incredible in it. He directed a movie called... it's called Merry Gentlemen.
Yes.
That's pretty good.
Okay.
There's what's it called? Game 6.
Yeah.
Which is based on Don DeLillo novel, I want to say.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Like he would do these sort of smaller projects, but I think he was kind of cynical about his own career. Was acknowledged that he'd kind of lost it and didn't feel like fighting it too hard.
Right.
And would take the sort of like paycheck family gig every once in a while and then do like the smaller leading man
doing a lot of voice work. He's in Cars. Yeah. He's in Toy Story 3.
Yeah.
But like RoboCop, Need for Speed, Birdman are all 2014.
And like this is the era where I'm like, anytime Michael Keaton's in a movie, I got to go see it, support it, because they rarely let him do this. Like I go see Need for Speed opening weekend because he's ninth billed. And the fact that within that same year, he has the comeback. Like, I'm watching Need for Speed being like, it's really never happened, huh? And he's not bad in it. Like, I think he's always kind of good in this shit.
I liked him in Dumbo.
He's got the sequel to the movie that I'm not going to say the name of.
Yeah.
But he's also got this – he's got a Halle Meyer Shire movie coming up.
Yes. He does.
This sounds great.
Yeah. I think he has found a lane for himself. Yeah. Also, he's like getting paid, right? Like,
yeah.
He's in The Flash. He's in, I mean, Morbius, Batgirl, notwithstanding. Still getting, you know.
For a guy who like got knocked down so weirdly hard in the 90s, for not like, he didn't have like huge calamitous flops.
Correct.
He didn't have like Hudson Hawk Waterworld-esque. No. What a hubristic disaster.
Sure.
He just kind of made middling movies that didn't really connect, and everyone was like, well, Michael Keaton, you know, like, I guess that.
Yeah, it's like Multiplicity and Shetland Speechless.
He also made some movies that people came to like on video.
Yeah,
like,
Multiplicity being a great example, where you're like, that's weird that bombed that hard.
Yeah.
That should have been a comeback of him kind of giving audiences, great, I'll go back and do kind of Mr. Mom-esque.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Right. And it didn't work, but it's odd that post Birdman, he's in a zone where like he's made tons of shitty movies in the last 10 years.
Yes.
And some that feel like cynical paycheck movies,
sure.
Some that just feel like bad, failed prestige projects. He now feels kind of invincible.
I think he is. I mean, post Spotlight, like, he got this like angry dad thing.
Yeah.
Like shaking his fist at, you know, at the various, you know, Worth Trial of Chicago 7.
But whether or not like, those movies connect, people are like, we love Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
He's never going away.
Yeah.
He's like a national treasure, right? Like basically.
I didn't really love him in Dope Sick, but he wins an Emmy for it. Like everyone's
Dope Sick's not bad.
This is what we love.
Yeah. Yes. No, you just love it. And you're like, he is so now like minted.
He really is.
In a way that it's weird that everyone threw him out for 15 years because it's like he has the legacy status of like, look, he's always been a star. He will always be a star.
Yeah.
When in fact he was like so dinged. And I wonder, you have to imagine a movie. We've obviously analyzed a lot of story mistakes in this film.
Yeah.
That it's not like I feel if Michael Keaton had done it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
It would have automatically fixed all of those things, or he would have fixed those things. Lord knows, maybe the reason he dropped out is because the script wasn't totally working.
Yeah.
I have no fucking idea. I do think if he were in this movie, it would have been a bigger hit. If that makes any sense.
I think so, too.
Even the exact same movie would have been a bigger hit and would have maybe built a better bridge to what the next stage of his career is.
This exact same movie, I don't think he gets an Oscar nomination, but I think people talk about it.
I think he gets a Globe nomination.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think also this in the same year as Batman Returns, right? Batman Returns in the summer and this in the fall.
Better counterpoint for him.
I agree with that.
Than Martin having House Sitter in this.
Totally agree.
Where everyone liked House Sitter, but they were like, yeah, it's another one of these.
Yeah.
There's nothing ambitious about it.
Absolutely.
And
Yeah. I mean, there's two other people I want to talk about before we bounce the plot real quick.
Yeah.
But the Deborah Winger of it all, which is she turns down A League of Their Own to do this film.
Yes.
Which is a choice. I think we're all better off that Gina Davis was in A League of Their Own, who's unbelievable in it. And by the way, watching Deborah Winger in this, I was like, yeah, but Deborah Winger would have been great in A League of Their Own too. It would have been a slightly different energy, but she would have killed it. But
this is also the height of the era of everyone saying, is Deborah Winger too difficult?
Is that – so she had a reputation for being, quote-unquote, difficult?
Okay. Yeah, and she's still like a major star at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's definitely starting to become a thing where it's like, is she losing roles because people don't want to put up for her with her?
Interesting.
Or is she leaving projects because they're not agreeing with her?
Yeah. Interesting. The next year she does Shadowlands and gets nominated for the Academy Award.
Her last Oscar
nomination. And then she does Forget Paris in 95, and then she doesn't work for 6 years.
Yes.
Like she...
And in that time in between, searching for Deborah Winger... Yeah. The Roseanne Arquette documentary, using her as an example of how even the biggest star mm-hmm. of her generation is basically aged out of Hollywood by 35.
Yeah.
And then yeah. I think Roseanne Arquette uses her as the thesis to make this movie of what the fuck happened
yeah.
to Deborah Winger. How could someone be a big star who also is like Oscar perennial,
right.
inevitable, seen as like one of these days they're going to hand her Best Actress. And then she just pieces out. And Deborah Winger, I think, has talked about, and this is sort of what the documentary gets to, of just like, I just kind of got tired of all of it. I didn't care.
Or and need it, I guess.
I didn't care, whatever.
She comes, I mean, she's great in Rachel Getting Married.
Incredible.
She should have got an Oscar nomination
that
probably
was
for that.
Really positioned as her like reclamation project.
Right.
The stuff she does in between when she comes out of retirement, Rachel Getting Married, is like, why is she playing Ed Harris's wife in Radio? That was Radio. A true like reviews pinning. This is her first movie in 7 years. Why is she doing this? This is the most thankless. Like, yeah. This is why you assume she left Hollywood, to not get stuck doing this type of role.
So she's actually in two movies in 93. She's in A Dangerous Woman and Shadowlands. And she gets a bunch of critics nominations.
Combined.
For Dangerous Woman. Yeah. It's like weird that both of... I never saw A Dangerous Woman.
I've never seen either.
But yeah, I mean, it is interesting because, I mean, listen, the moniker of difficult woman in Hollywood is its own fucking ridiculous thing
yes.
in of itself. So yeah. I don't want to read too much into what that was, but it certainly seemed to affect her career.
Some of these cases, it's very hard to really analyze because certainly I think sure. the deck was stacked against actresses who were expected to not have opinions.
Sure.
I think there was
all actresses.
Right,
yes.
Right. Yeah. There was this sort of notion of you should feel grateful right. of what we're giving you.
Right.
In ways where it's just like you hear the stories about like the fucking 90s leading men and the insane yeah. ego trips they go on.
Absolutely.
And when the movies work, they not only are forgiven, sure. but it's like that's what makes them such a great artist.
I mean, you guys just did Barbra Streisand, which is yeah. a perfect example yes. of all of that shit
totally.
Times 10.
But that's sort of like Kevin Costner vindicated.
Yep, yep.
He never gave up and he was right about everything. Mel was right about everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's sort of like, you know, Bruce's like weird mm-hmm. vanity projects, winning and losing and all of that. And I just have always gotten the vibe from her. Whereas there's some other actresses of the 90s where you're like, it might have been Column A and Column B.
Right.
They
right.
might have been judged more harshly for behavior every male star would have gotten away with, but they also might have been a little prickly or a little mm-hmm. defensive in a way that makes sense because it's an industry that basically challenges you to become an asshole if you want to retain any autonomy.
Absolutely.
Deborah Winger has always read to me in interviews how she talks about it now as just like, I truly just like cared. And I was like not willing to go along with it.
Yeah.
And I would like put my foot down about like this story thing, like this choice will like play against the integrity of my character. And everyone was just like, shut up, Deborah, take the money.
I do think it's in like her breakthrough's Urban Cowboy, which I watched for the yeah. first time last year.
Not a bad
is,
movie.
Is a good movie. Yeah. She gets so many awards nominations for that. And the thing about it is that movie, she fought everyone because
yeah.
it's a movie about spousal abuse yeah. that is like, she should just be okay with this. And she fought it every step of the way and like made that movie more complicated. It still is kind of a movie about spousal abuse, but like it is.
And Mechanical Bulls.
And yeah. yeah, Mechanical Bulls. Yeah. It is the Mechanical Bull is abusing his wife.
And what's fascinating about her is you're like, she was similarly proven right a bunch.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. The yeah. thing she put her foot down about, and like, I'm sorry, in a lot of these cases, especially if you're an actress, the only way to win these arguments is to turn them into arguments. They will not listen to casual, hey, can I like throw out some ideas or notes? Mm-hmm. You have to put your fucking foot down and go, I refuse to shoot the scene this way.
It also should be said that in the research I did, this director, Richard Pierce, who yep. did Leap of Faith, maybe a little over his skis,
yeah.
Maybe in a position with big personalities that he was not able to deal with either.
Yep.
And it seems as though whatever you have to say about Deborah Winger's thoughts or notes or what have you, there's a lot of directors that just don't know how to process that type of stuff and don't know how to really deal with that stuff. And that might be on the screen as well.
Yeah, but I mean,
she's really good in this movie, though. Yeah. Like, I mean, despite the fact that I don't know that she's really given the best arc.
No.
She's given no arc.
Better version of this. I mean, we're talking about, like, the composite character, right? Could you imagine if this movie was her playing the love interest slash antagonist off of Steve Martin?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's perfect.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Or like if you make this movie about like maybe you make them married and you're like their marriage is falling apart in this town. That's also a movie that gives her more to do.
This relationship between her and Liam Neeson
is like missing the scenes where it actually happens.
Missing the scenes where they actually do have pretty good chemistry.
They do.
Liam Neeson's accent is fucking bonkers.
I mean, one of the most fascinating examples for me of a guy who's basically never been able to successfully pull off an accent that totally covers his own accent, but he does it with such confidence that we all just accept, like, well, that's hilarious.
Not in this, though.
I didn't have that thought once. I was just I was just like, you know what? This accent isn't quite working, but it's working for me.
That's my thing.
You know?
I feel like there are a lot of other actors I watch where, and even major movie stars where you can feel their self-consciousness about the accent not working.
That's fair.
And that's what tanks the performance.
Yes.
And he always is just like, I don't care if I don't sound like
you're absolutely right
any human point. Being in history. No one has sounded the way I talk, but I'm just like emotionally locked into these scenes. And I'm just asking you all to agree fucking with that. Ignore it.
Do you know what Liam Neeson's first credited role is on Wikipedia?
No.
He plays Jesus Christ. So this is
he's come full circle.
He's in the Jesus cinematic universe now with this movie and that one.
It's interesting. This movie obviously comes the year before Schindler's List.
Yeah.
He conceivably goes from this set to the set of Schindler's List.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is nuts to think about. He's also in Husbands and Wives in 92 as well. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, whatever. But in this role, which I think he does a pretty good job in, all things considered, he goes toe-to-toe with Steve Martin in some – like, these are two very different energies.
Yes.
And yet it works when they are in scenes together.
And he's very good with Deborah Winger.
He's very good with Deborah.
But there is that problem of, like, he's standing in opposition of trying to bust Steve Martin. But they don't have that many scenes together.
Yes.
And then he has this like surprising opposites attract romance with Deborah Winger. Mm-hmm. But Deborah Winger's attitude is just like, she's not as craven as the other guys on the bus.
Yeah.
But she's also not as cynical as Steve Martin. She's smart enough to get what they're doing, but also isn't like, it's just sort of like, it's a job and it makes people happy. Where he can't really have major moral qualms with her. No. And their chemistry is good, but it does feel like it skips straight from, God, I'm fighting with this person, but weirdly it feels like we have good energy, to we're now like super comfortable domesticated.
I said this to you off mic before we started, but like, my big issue with their relationship, with the relationship between Deborah Winger and Liam Neeson is I don't buy for a second that she wouldn't be bored in 3 months and just be like, why am I living in buttfuck Kansas with this guy?
I would be fine with it, to be clear.
But you would also be fine with Travis Kelce, right?
I would. He's a very attractive man, is the thing.
But I digress. I do think that...
Also, Kansas City is not Rustwater, Kansas.
I hear you. I just think that it just feels to me as though Deborah Winger's having a crisis of faith, obviously. She's like, why are we doing this? This is probably bad for everybody. She's fallen for this.
She's very quickly aligning herself with the guy.
Right.
Yes.
And he is very attractive. I get it. And there is something very idyllic about this life that he's living in this town and all. I get all of that. But I also feel like every scene... like when they're fucking sitting around with butterflies or they're, you know, in swinging chairs on porches. I'm just like, you're going to be bored in two months.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that's just a fundamental flaw for me in believing that she would ever leave this life with Steve Martin.
By the way, I would believe it more with Steve Martin's character having this type of romance. Cause like, for a guy like this, just to have any level of like, emotional honesty with a person would feel so intoxicating to him.
Sure.
He keeps everyone at such arm's length.
Sure.
That if someone got through to him in this way,
right,
And he was just like, fuck, I'm like sitting on a fucking...
Which is what I expected the Lita Davidovich character to right. be.
Everything in this movie works if Steve Martin and Liam Neeson fall for each other. Yes. Genuinely. Yes. If this is a queer story...
I disagree.
Yes.
Like, I don't disagree. I mean, there is something... Their relationship, quite honestly, their sort of like yin and yang of the way that they see the world is quite fascinating. When they are sort of at odds with each other in the tent and they're like in front of an audience...
Yeah.
Battling for moral superiority, if you will, is a really interesting and complex thing.
When they finally combine the characters for Broadway, Brooke Shields played the part.
Brooke Shields played sure. Marva when she was still just a waitress in LA. Gotcha. And then they like fired her and they brought in like a real Broadway person. Okay.
Cause I was going to say like Brooke Shields as the female Liam Neeson kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it kind of does. Really? It kind of does.
Okay. That's like the kind of person you want to play. Cause it's, right, it's that, once again, like, I do think you could put Deborah Winger in this role. There were two extraneous characters, basically.
Yep.
And the Deborah Winger one feels less extraneous because it is so well performed.
Yeah.
The other role that's worth mentioning that Liam Neeson plays in 1982 is in a film called Shining Through, which is the Michael Douglas, Melanie Griffith Holocaust movie where Liam Neeson plays a Nazi.
Yeah.
You have to wonder whether or not maybe Spielberg saw that and was like, correct. This guy might be able to do this.
Yeah.
But I also just feel like Liam Neeson's career, you guys obviously talked about Darkman when you guys were doing your Raimi series, and that sort of feels like a moment where I'm sure Hollywood noticed him, but didn't really commit to him.
I mean, he had for a long time this kind of career that doesn't really exist anymore, which is movie stars used to make fewer projects.
Sure.
Right? Like top stars were not in 5 movies a year and also 2 TV shows and also commercials or whatever. People just work a lot more now.
Yeah.
Because if you were on the A-list, you had to be a little protective of like
totally.
Your brand, and no one gives a shit about anything anymore. But also, like, studios were making more mid to low budget sized movies where you were like, look, we're going to try to offer Darkman to like Harrison Ford. If Harrison Ford wants to do it, we'll happily bump this up to a $60 million budget. But if he passes, we'll still make Darkman for 15. Mm-hmm. So who are the guys who like you can slot into Darkman at 15? And there's that like grouping of actors where you're like, oh, someone like Liam Neeson, who's been doing it for 15, 20 years,
sure.
probably a familiar face to audiences, has certain lean man qualities, has never been a box office draw, is not necessarily a movie star in a conventional sense, but why not slot him in there? And then like Schindler's List gives him the gravitas.
Well, yeah. I mean, then it's a whole lot of...
Right. Then it's the next phase of like he is sort of prestige actor combined with high price, bring him in to add legitimacy to your blockbuster. But now he's like the elder statesman. And then, of course, has the weirdest late career.
As an action hero.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the sort of... What's interesting, too, about like the Darkman
exactly
thing...
He was at this point in time, which is he's either going to be like the lead of a movie that's a lower priority at a studio, or he'll be like one of the key supporting characters.
And then Spielberg makes him a movie star.
Yes.
Yeah. It's, I mean, the Darkman thing, what's interesting too, and we've talked about this a little bit in past episodes, but like the video store culture, a movie that can make, you know, $10 or $12 or $15 million in theaters and then double that when it comes out on video was a real thing. And Darkman's a perfect example of that. They obviously had a bunch of straight to video sequels to it, but like, that type of movie star that can be on a big screen, that's enough of a draw that gets people to go to the theaters, but is also fine on a TV screen
and
on
it's
video.
It's just kind of like steady hand shit. They're like, this guy's like, he's just a pro. He's going to fucking cover it. We don't need to sell the movie on his name that much, but also people are comfortable with him.
What's interesting about this is that slot now is increasingly taken by faith-based Christian films.
Yeah.
Sure. It's like they have their stars.
Yep. Yes.
And they show in movies and people go see them, show in theaters, and people go see them in the movie theater, but also they're on video and DVD and they can show in churches for the rest of time.
And there's like the tiny level of like indie-specific stars, critics, darlings, what have you, within like the A24 neon realm. But like in a different timeline, Shea Whigham would have had like $5-10 million
absolutely
vehicles, right?
Yes.
Like there would have been movies that were developed as Mark Wahlberg vehicles where it's like Wahlberg dropped out. Can we do it with Shea?
Yeah.
It's already like moving forward. He's just
great.
And everyone likes him.
Yeah.
He's not great. A movie star, but he's like great on screen and people have fond feelings. But yeah, Neeson's in this like kind of weird slot at this
point. I also think that the faith-based thing is interesting too, because I think that there is kind of, and faith might be a strange word to associate with Liam Neeson, but if you look at his sort of prestige roles, right, mm-hmm. they all have this kind of larger than life, kind of mythic, almost Jesus-esque
he's
of characters.
A deeply religious man, as evidenced by the fact that I've been getting served a lot of targeted ads for Halo, Mark Wahlberg's prayer app, which Liam Neeson performs on.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sure.
I got it.
Are you familiar with Halo?
I'm not.
Mark Wahlberg has basically created his religious version of the Calm app, where it's guided prayers. But okay. Liam Neeson,
I can see that being very successful.
Does a lot of them. And when
he's got a great voice.
When I watch those ads, I'm like, you know what? I kind of want to just pay to be able to listen Liam Neeson say shit.
I mean, he has a foundational tragedy in his life.
Yes.
That like leads, and I think that leads him deeper into faith. But unlike Chris Pratt, he's not like really showy about it.
Yeah.
I think that like if you look at
also like Aslan, like he has. Yes. Sure.
I mean, even if you look at Rob Roy, Michael Collins, even Qui-Gon, Les Mis. I mean, these are all very sort of spiritual type characters.
And Oscar Schindler feels like a biblical very much type character.
Absolutely.
In
For sure.
The test.
Absolutely.
That is placed in front of him.
Of course.
Yes. I really went all in on him winning an Oscar for Silence, and then he's barely in it. He's so good in it.
I agreed. Even when I saw his part was smaller than I imagined, I was like, well, easiest walk to a nomination ever. Mm-hmm. Part of it's probably that movie is just too challenging for people. Mm. But that comes out at like when he's still kind of top value as an action star. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how are people not doing cartwheels over the fact that he went back and did his old shit?
Yeah.
And at like arguably a greater depth than he'd ever done before.
He's amazing in that movie. I also I'm a little surprised he hasn't worked with Nolan again. Like, he does seem like a guy that Nolan, you know what I mean? Like, when he shows up in Batman Begins, you're like, yes, that makes sense. And he just kind of never does again.
Nolan found Kenneth Branagh. And now it's like, that's like, you know.
He found his other accent guy?
Yeah.
No, fair enough.
But there's also like, he, as much as now the quality of his action movies has really dipped.
Yes.
And they feel like they're all made through like weird, shady money laundering, foreign financing and whatever.
Yes.
And it's just kind of like, well, whatever's willing to meet his quote, he will sign up and hold a gun on a poster. It's not like he has abandoned making other types of movies.
No.
He still does, like, I'll do a serious, like, indie. Mm-hmm. I'll, like, take a supporting role in a drama.
Sure.
But it doesn't, I don't know. I'm, like, waiting for him to have his final stage of, like.
I think he will.
Yeah.
I also, his episode of Atlanta is incredible. When he showed up in Atlanta as just a crawling inside himself based on, obviously, the controversy that sort of spiraled around him was fascinating in and of itself.
Yes.
You know, also, you know, his episode of Extras, like, he's able to take the piss out of himself as well. He's great in Widows.
I mean,
like,
incredible in Widows. Here's the thing we should fucking just acknowledge. The movie that would kind of reset his career, not that it would lead to the types of parts we're saying we want to see him do more of, but like what he actually needs to reframe himself within Hollywood is fucking Naked Gun.
Yeah.
Which he keeps on being like, I don't know, it's risky, I don't know if I should do it.
Do it.
But he'd be amazing.
No, but you know it's like a thing on the runway.
Really?
Yes. Seth MacFarlane, who has worked with him a couple times.
I mean, this sounds great.
It sounds amazing.
And fucking Akiva Schaffer.
Oh, wow.
Writing and directing.
Yeah, he should just do that.
Yes.
I would also argue, what has he got to lose at this
Nothing.
Point?
Like, and the other part of this is you're like, Frank Drebin is riffing on the cop procedural shows of the time.
Yes, yes.
If you were to update Naked Gun today, it would have to be riffing on the Europa Corp Liam Neeson.
Right.
Like, that's the model now. And Liam Neeson, anytime he is given silly dialogue in a comedy, and people just have him say it very seriously.
He's
fucking Leslie Nielsen style. It's funny.
Yeah.
I watched Ted 2 for the first time recently.
Never saw Ted 2.
So embarrassing. It took me that long
for the TV show.
Yes, exactly. Which then I I mean, in a way that really speaks to the current state of my mental health, watched all of. Do you know the first episode of the TED TV show is 50 minutes long?
I did know that because I watched the football game that immediately preceded it because, of course, I'm married to Travis Kelce as well. Right, of course. Yeah. And like, I was like, and it was like, now stay tuned for the debut of TED. And I had lost my remote. I was like turning my office over. Yeah. And so I watched the first like 2 minutes and I hit pause and I was like, this is 50?
Yeah.
Never went back.
Yeah, instant.
I've not watched it.
So he's got a bit in TED 2.
Ted or Liam?
Liam Neeson in TED.
Okay, okay.
I feel no need to stand the comedy chops of Ted the Bear. This is purely a Liam Neeson shout out. He's got a scene in TED 2 where Ted, of course, works at a grocery store.
Sure.
And Liam Neeson comes to the checkout. Mm-hmm. Like holding something inside his leather jacket, like it's a gun. Uh-huh. And then like sort of like looks like both ways and puts a box of tricks on the counter and just does the bit of like, will you let me buy this cereal? I know I am not a kid and I have heard tricks are for kids.
It sounds good.
But does it like the stakes are like, are you going to let me leave this supermarket alive? Am I going to be apprehended for trying to buy that? And I'm just like, give me 80 minutes of this.
It sounds great. Yeah. I'm in.
Yes.
I'm not to watch TED 2, but for Liam Neeson to do Naked
Gun. Are you going to watch the full TED series?
You got to know. No, I'm good. I'm all right.
It's a brisk 15 hours. It's also like weirdly like half family dramedy. Here's another thing I find interesting about this movie.
Yeah.
Someone in the Blank Check subreddit the other day said it started a thread that was, can you explain to me what the boys mean when they refer to something as a genre film? And their question was, I hear them throw that term out a lot, but how is any movie not a genre movie? Their argument was, every film slots into some type of genre.
Sure.
And the answer is, it's basically an antiquated term now, because we rarely get movies that aren't genre films or don't fit into some sort of ersatz genre that we've now like retrofitted, sure, like indie drama or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the reason that term exists is because studio movies used to be like this.
Yep.
Like, Leap of Faith is the example of why other films are called genre movies, because this is unclassifiable.
100%.
And you used to get a lot of movies that were like high-level people making a film that's sort of six things at the same time.
I mean, we've covered a lot of them in 92.
Right. It's a wild time.
Right. And it's time. No one was like, oh, tonal messiness. Yeah. There was this feeling of like, well, genre movies are B pictures. They're the bonus film you get with your ticket. And that's an easy, cheap sell of, it's a monster movie. Mm-hmm. It's a slapstick comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a musical, whatever it is. But there used to be these kinds of movies where you're like, it's a like dramedy romance ideas film.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a perfect example of, you know, we've talked a fair amount about this kind of weird slipstream that 92 exists in before, you know, Hollywood becomes fully indoctrinated into franchises and what have you and genres that you're talking about. But it where, you know, this movie cost $20 million to make, which now is probably 50, let's just say, which still is not a crazy amount of money, all things considered.
It's also like, in terms of the movies released in 92, how this looks, it's so gorgeous. It's so beautiful. Yeah,
it looks great. It looks great.
We didn't know how good we had it.
We really didn't. I mean, it is, I was looking at it from a production perspective, kind of put those goggles on for a moment and just thought about how much takes place in that tent, as we've talked about.
Yes.
So it's really kind of a one location movie.
Another reason I think they thought it could be a stage show.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
But it's all location work. There's no soundstage work whatsoever, at least from what I could glean. It's a movie for adults.
It is.
It's not for kids.
These sort of like full course meal movies where they're like, we're giving you a course of everything, you know?
Totally.
Like Ghost is like, for how successful Ghost is, that's a movie where like you could ask 10 different people what genre is that and they'd give you different answers. Mm-hmm. It is simultaneously like a comedy.
Supernatural,
drama, romance, thriller.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but Ghost is an example of a movie that shouldn't work.
Correct.
And yet somehow just hits all of the erogenous zones that people want.
That's a bigger swing than most.
Yes.
But still, most studio movies at this time, especially like A-list star vehicles,
mm-hmm.
were three or four things at the same time in a way that sort of avoided classification.
Absolutely.
And made genre films feel like, well, those are kind of simpler things.
Absolutely.
If a movie's only trying to do one thing on a base level, that's a genre movie. And that's why it was thought of as a reductive term.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... So, as I was watching this, I had to ask myself, Steve Martin, hot?
Yeah.
Sexy?
Sexy's an interesting...
Because there's a moment in this movie where Steve Martin is jogging in a crop top and a cowboy hat, and I'm like, I don't know what we're doing here.
You get some Steve Martin chest in this.
Yeah.
And some, like, midriff.
Yeah. I think he is undeniably very sort of underrated as a deeply handsome movie star.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you think...
He looks too much like my terrible father for me to be like, I think this guy's hot, but
if our listeners could have seen the look that I just gave,
I will say people often said that my terrible father was attractive. So
okay. I put it this way too. I would say he is bizarrely conventionally handsome for a comedy star.
Yes.
Without feeling like he's a pretty boy.
Yeah.
You know, where like someone like Chevy Chase, the appeal was like, oh my God, he looks like that and he does comedy.
Sure.
Which then, you know, sours completely or whatever.
Yeah, I think like young Steve Martin,
he's kind of
like
sneaky hot.
And then
without ever feeling like he was relying on it. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
He was never doing Aren't I Cute, Aren't I Charming shit.
He is hot in like, I think LA Story, which again, I haven't rewatched relatively recently, but like kind of hits that right on the nose, right? Which is, that's kind of an overtly sexy comedy at times, and it works for him.
Yeah.
And it also has this kind of almost surreal, mystical kind of component to it that allows for a little bit of rope for him to play. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not saying he's not hot. In this movie, I don't know if he's hitting all the erogenous zones.
And I do think, not to trigger anything, Emily, but I do think an aspect of his hotness is his, like, dad status.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something to, like, how sort of non-threatening, domesticated.
Right.
You know? Like, there's something...
A big late 80s thing for him is, as like, where he might get awards attention is Roxanne.
Yes.
Like saying, oh, now he's ugly. And you're like, was he hot before? And you're like, he kind of was, actually.
Right.
Yeah. But versus like so many of...
Like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I think he's supposed to be hot in that, right?
Kind of. But he's also supposed to be like unseemly in that.
But isn't that supposed to be kind of hot?
Yeah, I'm just saying he successfully transitions to being a comedy star who 100% feels like he's part of the establishment.
Yes.
While other guys are still doing the sort of like too smart for the room, mm-hmm. I'm fucking with authority figures, whatever thing.
Right.
There's something so like, my sister would sort of use this term about like actors she had a crush on, where she was like, he'd look good in sweaters, which speaks to her taste.
Sure. Well, but Steve Martin is in a Nancy Meyers movie. So, like, he does have, and I don't say that to say, like, he, you know, isn't.
No, in the Father of the Bride movies or Nancy Shire movies. Yeah.
Warm kind of quality to him. As we said, he's not dangerous.
Right? I briefly pitched a site for online pornography. I didn't actually pitch this. This was a joke I had for something. It was called sweatersoff.com, which is just like people in winter wear in like warm cabins then like slowly removing the winter wear. And Steve Martin perfectly would fit on sweatersoff.com.
Steve is daddy.
Steve is daddy. I want to ask, this is more maybe specifically to you, Emily, but there's this moment when Jonas, the Steve Martin character, kind of has a crisis of conscience or what have you, and he sort of yells at Jesus up on the cross, and he says, why'd you make so many suckers?
Mm-hmm. This is after Lucas Haas.
This is after Lucas Haas, which I thought was a really, I mean, I the idea of like, Steve Martin yelling at Jesus is fine, whatever. But like that question, this idea of sort of huckster religion, organized religion, all that kind of stuff. I think it's interesting that the movie goes there, right? That it tries to be a kind of, you know.
I'm interested in how that intersects with how Hollywood traditionally treats Christians.
Yeah.
Which is You know, now I the big project that Libby and I broke through on is specifically about evangelical Christian America. Like, we that's what got hired on Yellow Jackets. We've almost had that made like 15 times. And then someone realizes it's about religion and specifically treats religion seriously. Right, and they're like, no, we're not going to do this.
Is the attitude almost like this will piss both sides off? It religious crowds is. Will think this is a little too tough for them.
Yeah.
And people who aren't religious will write it off as a faith-based film.
Because it's about queer Christians.
Right.
And everyone's like, what the fuck do we do with that?
Yeah, right.
So I think, but one of the things I take, have always taken is The Leftovers, the HBO show.
Sure.
I did an interview with them once where they
were
like,
a lot of Lindelof's work.
Our biggest audience is actually evangelical, young evangelicals who are like, we want to see stuff that is talking about these ideas. Mm-hmm.
In a challenging way.
We don't need it to be, you know, explicitly faith-based. But I think that the only way that gets made is Lindelof has a blank check at HBO to get that thing made. I think that, like, this movie was embraced by evangelicals to some extent because it is interested in, like, this guy confronting that question.
The whole second half of the movie should be about rather than the last 15
and minutes. Coming away from it in a way where he, like, sort of respects people's faith even if he doesn't share it ultimately. Like, I do think, like, one of the things that trips Hollywood up when it makes movies about any religious tradition, because I think everyone who works here, like, I'm Episcopalian, which is the most secular Christian you can possibly be, but, like, still nominally Christian. And, like, the thing that gets Hollywood tripped up is we all are kind of like, well, nobody actually believes this, right? Like, this isn't like a thing that people organize their life around. And Leap of Faith is, I think, a little cynical about it, but does deep down think these people believe all of this. Yeah. And this guy is taking advantage of that. And there's something wrong with that.
Well, and what I do think is interesting about this movie and why the Lucas Haas walking needs to be the halfway point is that that's the most interesting idea. Is like him seeing this kid who's the kind of like, fuck, this guy gets me in trouble because he's got an actual condition I can't ail. And then Lilia Davidovich tells him, no, it's psychosomatic. Every doctor has been completely confounded by this. No one could get through to him. And he gets through in a way that is pointedly not a miracle, but certainly plays as a miracle to everyone else.
Sure.
He knows that what he did was not supernatural because he knows what she's told him about him.
Sure.
But suddenly he looks more real to everyone else. He's given this kid who does believe that he truly had a physical condition up until this moment, like a reaffirmation of everything he believed in. And Martin has to kind of reckon with, is there actually a positive good to what I'm doing? Which is what scares this guy the most, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I'm just tricking people and running off with their money, whatever, they're rubes, they want to believe this stuff.
Yeah.
They do believe this stuff.
I give them a good show,
and I don't really do anything to, like, lead them astray. I'm sort of playing into what they already believe.
Yeah.
But he's like, there's actually some power in the show I've put on removing some block in this kid that let him believe that he could suddenly walk again, which is what no traditional doctor or psychiatrist was able to do.
Yep.
And the thing I realized watching this and like Menken being so fixed on trying to make a musical out of this, it is interesting that around the same time, I feel like this is what, in a very different form, Book of Mormon is doing as a show.
Yes.
Which is like, make a show that's basically act one. This is all dumb. This is cynical.
Sure.
This is like people trying to cover their ass or like find some sort of like career success for themselves. And it gets out of hand.
Yeah.
They lose control of the narrative. And then they ultimately come to realize like it actually doesn't matter whether or not any of this is real or whether or not these people actually even believe it's real. They're buying what you're selling because they need some system to believe in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And like there is power in that even if it's coming from a cynical place. Weirdly.
I think that the movie, it's interesting. It's grappling with these ideas.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, as we were talking about obscure evangelical Christian figures, I was thinking about a guy named Mike Warnke, who I think this movie, he's exposed in 92. So this movie could not be based on him, but I think would be an interesting figure for a Steve Martin to play. Basically, He is a stand-up comedian, a Christian stand-up comedian who goes up and does 30 minutes of material. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, I'm going to talk for 15 minutes about how I was a Satanist and I sacrificed a bunch of children. And like, that's the like last 15 minutes.
Jesus, okay.
And he made all of that up. And like, that was like, okay. He'd made up this entire story about how he was seduced into Satanism and rose through the ranks of the church and blah, blah, blah. And was like interviewed on 2020 and was about
the
this
point of that narrative. The like, anyone can be saved.
Yeah. Basically of, okay. He's like, and Jesus found me and gave me the path forward. And like
he just tried to create the most dramatic stakes from what he was pulling out of.
And his claims got more and more extravagant. He's finally exposed in 1992, but like Steve Martin playing that guy, the guy who's funny. And then it's like,
that's
I got a level with you about all the times that I was involved in ritualistic sacrifice.
This is the thing. I'm kind of obsessed with movies like this where you watch them and you're like, God, I'm imagining the 15 better versions of this I could watch.
Yep.
And they're all different.
Yep.
Right? You're like, this movie isn't committing to one thing coherently, but it has the pieces of so many different versions of this story.
It really does. I mean, I'll say that 20 minutes into this movie, I was like, all right, is this a masterpiece that no one knows about? Because I genuinely, we talked about sort of that opening scene where you've got like the cop and him sort of piecing together the cop's story and playing the cop coming into the small town. I've got Meatloaf and Philip Seymour Hoffman on the bus. And like, I'm just like, it's just like is this going to be great?
Yeah.
And then it just slowly but surely kind of loses the thread a little bit.
And then gets most interesting at the very end.
And then gets most interesting in the last 50 minutes. It's very strange.
Another thing that's interesting about Mike Warnke that I think a lot of these movies miss is like he was exposed by a Christian publication. Like the people who brought him down were Christians.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in a lot of these stories. Yeah.
Right.
There was like a robust evangelical journalism scene at that time that was like taken, and that doesn't exist anymore. But I gotta say, when this movie came out, my comedy Mount Rushmore was Robin Williams, Mike Warnke, and Jim Varney, with like a fourth phase to be filled in later.
Yeah.
So
when are you making your evangelist journalist movie? Is the real question.
I should do that.
I mean, what I think is interesting about that too is the idea of putting people under a microscope in what is entirely like, it's not. Forgive me, but not fact-based. Like, how do you grapple with that?
Well, I mean, his stories were so obviously fake that they very easily tore them down. It was it is this thing of like, there was a sort of robust fact-checking. We don't want anybody to be taken advantage of. And there's a lot of scam artists.
Like
and
a defensive, we That's can't fall for another one of these guys.
Yeah.
Self-policing.
I'd like to rate this film because I'd love to get your thoughts on what we're covering next week, Griffin.
Okay. I do land on, I would say, I like this movie.
Me too. I do too.
But I'm like, I can't think of how to rate it that isn't either giving it too much credit or being too hard on it.
Yeah, I mean, so I came into this at a 70.
Mm. Yeah.
Too high.
And
I agree. But then also I'm like, also 60 I'm like, feels too low.
I came in at a 70. I'm just like, I'm going to be generous and say 70.
Yeah.
And I agree that that's probably a little too generous. It's probably a 65 is probably where I'm going to land. But that's where
I use the term gentleman six a lot on Blank Check.
I do. Yeah.
And that for me is a movie that is like doing an okay job with very low ambitions. Like you just kind of give it the bump of like, you know what? Why not? It's not hurting anybody. But it's hard for a movie like this to be a gentleman six because you're seeing so
aspirations.
Clearly, yes. And the things you wish it was doing.
Yes.
But then I'm also like, well, you can't give it a 7 for ambition. I think it is like a 65. Yeah. I think it's a 6.5.
Yeah. I think that's probably where it's at.
When I saw this in 1995 or whenever, I probably would have given it a 75. I quite liked it. Sure. I was not like in love with it, but I quite liked it. Watching it now, I was like, there's a lot of, it's a movie I'm fascinated by as a writer. Cause I was like, I have 15 different things I would like to do with this premise.
I would love to rewrite
this. The other thing I thought about here is I think a smart thing the musical does is introduces a different religious family that like believes sincerely, like as a counterpoint. This movie could have done that. Anyway, I'm going to give it a 62.
Okay.
On the queer phobia scale, I'm going to give it like a 4. Cause there is one joke about men wearing pantyhose. I was being crazy, and I was like, unacceptable.
That's not cool.
I think the rest of it's actually kind of fine, but 4.
As weird as it is that Alan Menken latched onto this, you also see that kind of thing of like, it less often works when you make a musical out of a thing that everyone loves that already yep. existed in a perfect form.
Yep. Right.
Like compared to the Ghost musical, which was also like...
They did a Ghost musical?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That Devane Joy Randolph won the Tony for, was nominated for. That was her breakthrough.
Really?
Was playing the Whoopi part in Ghost mm-hmm. on Broadway. Oh, I think it was okay. big in London and it was really hyped up, very similar to the Rocky musical. And it was very expensive and came to New York and like just absolutely that, wiped out.
The Rocky musical, conceptually really fascinating.
Yes.
Like how they staged it. You've got to watch some
but
clips.
All these
of it.
Things yeah. where you're like, that's not the version of the story that the people who like this movie want to see.
Can I ask? Here's a question.
Yeah.
What is the brass ring? Because in terms of making a movie into a musical, what is the goal? Because I hear of all of these yeah. being done, right? You know, your Beetlejuices, your what have yous. And I'm like, what are you striving for?
The problem Hollywood has with IP,
yeah.
Broadway had that in the 2000s. Like that's just, it's just, you can only get some, and like sometimes they're quite good. Like the musical about the aforementioned Gentleman Ghost is quite a good show, but like, okay. you know.
But I think like you okay. look more often, the successes are the things like Kinky Boots, Over the yes, Ground.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Where it's either like, or The Band's Visit, you know, which was right. like a fucking like Oscar foreign film shortlist movie from 15 or it's years
like,
earlier.
Or like one, probably going to end up being the biggest show of all time, The Lion King, which right, radically right. reimagines.
Well, yes, but the Disney ones were sort of
different. Yeah.
Right. They figured out basically the event horizon of like how to build the movies so they would transfer to Broadway perfectly.
Right.
And then you bring someone in to like, reinterpret it as a production, but like right. narratively, musically, there
becomes
just like
its own thing.
Clean yeah. placement, right?
The biggest non-Disney movie adaptation on Broadway by far is Hairspray, which is like
really?
A really like cool. Hairspray and the Producers are yeah. where it's like, oh, we can do this, and both of those are already musical adjacent.
Yes,
yeah. the film version.
I think so. That's a big part of it, but I think also like there are things where you're like, oh, there's like promises. Which gets like revived every 15 or 20 years and is a pretty good Burt Bacharach musical version of The Apartment.
Yeah.
And you're like, it doesn't crumble under the shadow of The Apartment, but it also doesn't surpass it. And everyone's like, this is kind of fun. And I feel like there were a lot of Broadway shows until the 2000s that were like that, where they're like, let's use the bones of this for a musical.
Sure.
And it does okay, but the original movie's the definitive text. And then in the 90s and 2000s especially, they start being like, we're making a musical with the same name and coasting off the iconography, uh-huh. and it's Mrs. Doubtfire singing and whatever it is, and it rarely works. And the best examples are the things like Kinky Boots or Band's Visit, where you're like, this movie is actually, people don't know it. It's
yeah.
based on a movie, but there aren't wide, like mainstream public expectations, uh-huh. or the sort of salvation project of, does Leap of Faith have good bones? Like, could we gut reno this
yeah.
and turn it into something that works? And you watch the movie and I keep on like, scene to scene, I'm watching it with the mind of like an interior designer in that way where I get what Alan Menken latched onto, where you're
totally
like,
get it.
Fuck, if you rip the walls out and you like, if the kitchen's here.
Another huge show was Once, the stage show.
Yeah.
Once.
Oh, right, of, like, course,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, this is a movie people have heard of, but maybe yes. don't know, and right. it's got great songs.
Yeah.
But like, Hadestown, one of my favorite things of all time. Huge hit show. Took them 10 years to get it to Broadway, even though everyone was like, this is clearly a Broadway show, because yeah. people were like, what's that about?
It had nothing.
The Orpheus Eurydice, and they're like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Can you maybe do a show based on a League of Their Own, something like that?
So before we talk about...
Actually astounding that hasn't happened
yet. I know.
Before exactly. we talk about what we're covering next week, do you guys have a favorite Steve Martin movie?
Honestly, it's probably Bowfinger.
I love Bowfinger.
Yeah.
I love Bowfinger. It feels lazy, but it also feels dishonest for me to pick anything other than The Jerk.
Right.
But mm-hmm. I also think basically it's, once again, it's a thing I find fascinating, is like, he is the rare comedy star
mm-hmm.
who has actually had several successful reinventions of his comedic persona.
Right.
Most comedians either kind of keep doing the same thing, diminishing returns,
mm-hmm.
or they take a left turn into drama or into action or whatever the
right.
fuck it is, right? And he's redefined a clean sort of type of what a Steve Martin movie is, mm-hmm. where I'm like, Bowfinger is one of those. The Jerk is one of those.
Sure.
They're 20 years apart, and it's hard for me to
reconcile.
Or just compare that, because I'm like, right. those are equally successful reflections of what his comedic persona style was at those moments. Like, if I'm just talking my favorite movie that he's in,
sure,
it's probably Little Shop, which is obviously not a Steve Martin movie, but also
he's so good.
It's one of his best performances ever.
Yeah.
So that's probably my like holy trinity.
Sure.
I mean, it's a lot. He was really good with Frank Oz.
Yeah. He was.
He was really good with Frank Oz and Carl Reiner, but the other Carl Reiner movies aren't as good as the second tier Oz movies.
I do love him in Planes, Trains, Automobiles.
Incredible.
Yeah. I love Parenthood. I know that that's, but I think that's probably the Steve Martin movie I've seen the most.
We haven't talked at all about Pennies from Heaven, which is just worth doing like two seconds on, which is like that was the time when it did feel like he was going to like that's right around when Robin Williams is doing GARP. So it feels like, oh, these guys are going to go to drama. And it doesn't work.
And that
doesn't work for either of them.
His second movie, period, after The Jerk. And he's talked about it of like, I wanted to try to break out and not pigeonhole myself to only doing my stand-up persona in movies. And audiences rejected it. And he was like, okay, note taken. And then just started doing different types of comedy.
Yeah.
But I do think that was the first movie that got him in his head about like, I don't know if audiences want to see me stretch or go into unfamiliar genres.
Anyway, speaking of Robin
Williams. He's good in it.
No, yeah. So you were originally going to come on for a film.
Okay.
That understandably you guys are going to cover on your podcast, which is the movie Toys at some point.
It feels like, look, before people fucking go on our Reddit and speculate, whatever, it is not a thing we have pinned on the schedule.
I understand. And I wasn't trying to.
And in a lot of ways, doing all of Levinson feels very daunting.
You got to do it.
You got to do it.
It is such an insane blank check movie that I feel like we cannot.
I totally understood.
An episode on
I completely understand that. And when we were emailing about this, I completely understood.
It's
you guys
also,
should give it its due.
Our buddy J.D. Amato is like obsessed with that film.
And totally understandable.
Where he's once or twice a year begging us to do an episode on it. So it's never been like locked in as anything.
I certainly don't want to send the Reddit people off saying you're going to be doing it anytime soon.
Or that we're definitively not. But it's truly just, it exists in the space where we're like, it's kind of break glass in case of emergency.
It's also such a long filmography. Like Levinson I think it would rival Burton in terms of length.
And basically everything in the 21st century is just like, there's some interesting movies in there, but who the fuck has ever heard of Pollywood? Oh, that's a documentary. You could get
Sims
away with
it. We're talking the other
Everlasting
day.
Peace.
Okay, there we go.
But then there are like 10 more after that.
Correct.
We were trying to crack our March Madness bracket where we
people
vote on directors 32 and do a vote every day. And we were like,
do we put Levinson on this?
Well, we were weighing it very seriously. And when someone's on the bubble like that, we go like, okay, let's just actually go through the films one by one and imagine doing this in real time and that taking however many months it takes. And there are filmmakers we've covered where we're like, their career's a little long and they have a bunch of movies at the beginning that don't really exist. Combine them, double them up, triple them up. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we did the first six Jonathan Demme movies as two episodes or something like that. And Levinson's the weird example of you would have to do the opposite. Where you're like,
gotta do Sphere?
Giving all his movies their own episodes until like 1999, maybe, or 2005. Yeah, and then you're like, the late ones all have to be doubled up. The Humbling cannot be its own episode. That has to be shared with Rock the Casbah.
I do feel like you could cut it off at Man of the Year. That feels like the last time it felt like Barry Levinson was Barry Levinson.
A deeply weird
flop.
So next week,
okay,
we have Emma Stefanski coming on to talk about Toys. The great Emma Stefanski, who has not seen Toys, but pretty convinced is going to be one of her favorite movies. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
It seems like, or she might just be like, I hate everything about this.
Yeah.
We had Emma on for Cool World.
Okay. And does she love that?
No.
None of us did.
Have you ever watched Cool World?
Yeah, it's unpleasant.
It's not good. Are you annoyed or a doodle, though? I got to ask.
That's a great question. I think I'm more of a doodle.
I think you are more of a doodle, actually, Griffin. But
no, that's a movie on paper I should love. And even for how broken it is, I should love the weird, broken left-handedness
really
of that movie. But it's actually just unpleasant.
It was the moment when Libby's wife called me and said, why are you making us watch this? I don't want Emily to do this podcast anymore. It felt reasonable, but
it really did feel like I was going to be made to quit podcasting altogether.
Yeah.
Like as an
industry. Was such a miserable experience, but Toys,
yes,
which is arguably one of the biggest blank check movies, right? This is this is a guy who's coming off of, you know, the success of Rain Man and Bugsy, big Oscar, what have you.
Even like size aside, it is truly the kind of thing they only let you make if you have a run of seemingly the Midas touch.
Correct.
Where it's like, look, this pitch sounds bad. Like, it's not just like that's more money than you are giving anyone unless they're coming off a run of hits and Oscars. Mm-hmm. It's like that thing would get noted to death.
Yes.
Outside of, fuck, well, Rain Man was the highest grossing film of its year. No one thought that was commercial either.
Sure. I mean, I think also they're putting on their studio hats being like, it is about toys.
Yeah.
So maybe we can make toys.
He's just made Good Morning Vietnam, Rain Man, Avalon, which is not a big hit, but like,
but it's an
amazing movie.
Well-loved film on a lower level. Yeah.
Bugsy, which is like, you know, not a good movie, but got a bunch of Oscar nominations. Yeah. He's like cashing in.
He is cashing in all. This is also notorious. We'll talk about this in the episode, but like, this was the movie he actually wanted to do first.
Yes.
This is the movie that he wanted to do before Diner.
Yep.
And thankfully, people were like, what are you talking about? Don't do that.
It's a movie that looks incredible, but it's also in this uncanny valley that I tend to love movies like this, where it is like too childish for adults and way too violent and cynical for kids.
That's kind of why I love it.
Oh,
where you're just like, this is kind of for no one.
That's the thing about this film.
It has that quality with Cool World, except I would say it is not unpleasant in the same way as Cool World.
No.
You're like, this is a movie that is alienating
to everyone.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the cast is insane.
You have to just be a deranged lunatic like us to love how ill-conceived it is in that level.
It is ill-conceived on many, many levels.
Yes.
This is Robin Williams come. I mean, obviously, we talked about Aladdin in 92.
Yeah.
Fern Gully, we also talked about that in 92. He's really kind of at a really big point in his career. He's had an Oscar nomination for Fisher King. He's got Hook. I mean, like,
Doubtfire is 93.
Doubtfire is the next year.
Right.
So, like, he literally comes off of this turd and goes right into a gigantic
success. Doubtfire is the moment where everyone, like, steps back and goes, like, is he actually the number one box office draw in Hollywood?
Correct.
Even with his flops aside, when this guy hits, it's so fucking big.
And he doesn't, you know, Jumanji's his next lead role, which is obviously a big hit as well. Then The Birdcage.
Yes.
I mean, then Jack, you know, and then things get a little bit bumpy.
It gets a little hairy.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was in that zone where it's like, everyone likes this guy. Kids like him as much as adults.
100%.
He's been in the public sphere now for like 20 plus years.
And Levinson uses the same approach that he has with Good Morning Vietnam, which is, I'm just going to point a camera at Robin and I'm going to let him riff.
Right.
The difference, of course, is he's riffing about just like everything under the sun, as opposed to Vietnam, where at least he's in a box to some degree.
I saw the great John Glazer, the comedic performer and writer. I saw him do a bit once in New York. I'm trying to remember where the venue was, but whatever. It's some, you know.
Sure.
Underground Eugene Merman hosted comedy show when those things were hard to sell tickets to. And he did a character who was a stand-up dreamedian. And his bit was, well, most comedians make observational comedy about like slice of life things we've all gone through, but that's like well picked over territory. So I'm going to do observational comedy based on my dreams. And the joke was, no one has any frame of reference for what he's explaining. So he would have to do like 90 seconds of someone poorly explaining their own dream to then set up the joke. And I'm thinking, you know, and whatever the punchline is. And Toys is kind of like that, where
it absolutely
Good Morning Vietnam, you're like, well, we all understand the Vietnam War.
Yep. Yeah.
And here are the bones of a solid drama.
Yep.
And place Robin within here.
Yeah.
You understand the time period. You understand where he is. You understand what's going on sociopolitically. He can riff on that.
Absolutely.
We have like touch points. And Toys is like, do observational comedy on the insane world of toys. And we're like, we don't get what the world of toys is.
We have no idea what's going on. It's sort of a Succession movie in the sense of him getting his father's company.
Yes.
Michael Gambon playing this sort of militaristic uncle.
Yes.
LL Cool J playing his son.
And like a movie, like a massive budget, like basically adaptation of the style of Magritte. Right.
What's the over-under on me giving this a 75?
I mean, I honestly think you might love this movie.
I'm taking the over, too. Yeah.
I mean, it is It's scrubbed from the internet. The only way you can watch it right now is on Stars. That's the only place that it's available.
Not rentable.
You can buy it on DVD.
But never on Blu-ray, right?
Never on Blu-ray.
I finally bought a 4K, so I'm waiting for that toy's 4K release.
But I honestly think that just fucking, like, why wouldn't 20th just put a deluxe edition of this out? They'd make money.
It feels like a Shout Factory thing at this point.
Sure.
It feels like a weirdo label.
Like someone, Arrow, whoever, whatever the fuck.
Yes.
Anyway, we're doing toys. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask your thoughts on it. You saw it as a kid? You didn't see it as a kid?
I saw it on TV as a child a couple years after it came out. I definitely didn't see it in theaters.
Did you play the video game?
I didn't. But I remember just constantly... I'm trying to think what channel it would have played on, but there was some cable channel that for a year maybe had it in regular rotation.
Maybe like Fox, whatever it's called, because it's...
I don't know
what it is. Yeah.
Like for whatever year we got cable, I was just then obsessed with watching cable television all the time. And I had this weird relationship to the movies that played in cable constantly that I assumed they're playing because they're classics. I didn't understand. It's like because this movie
to make
was
their money back.
Cheap, and it was cheap to license, and the studio's trying to make their money back or whatever.
Sure.
So, like, there's a group of movies that I all kind of put together of like Return to Oz, The Wiz.
She loves Return to
Toys,
Oz.
Toys. Yeah. Yes. All these movies that feel like children's movies that upset children, and were kind of neither fish nor fowl.
Uh huh.
And often had like really interesting adult directors and filmmakers behind them, but we're in this uncanny valley. And to me, all of them were like, well, this is like Mary Poppins levels. These are like the canonical classics.
Mm-hmm.
The difference with Toys was I could tell it was more recent.
Sure.
It was not a movie that had predated me, where I would just watch The Wiz and assume like, this is everyone's favorite movie of all time. It's as beloved as The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And I remember just every time Toys would come on, ask my parents like, so like, what's the read on this movie? Like, truly, even though I was a kid, I would, like, be like, so do people, like, do they like, was this movie liked? Was this movie popular?
Yeah.
I could tell there was something weird about how big it was
mm-hmm.
in relation to how weird it was mm-hmm. and how little it existed relative to other Robin Williams movies.
It was my first encounter with the term bad buzz.
Sure.
I ran an article about movies with bad buzz in the Argus Leader of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which I read and was like, now I know a Hollywood term.
Yeah.
And they were like, Toys has bad buzz. This was like November 1992.
Yeah.
Phil, my point, should I buy you this Japanese Toys poster? Because I kind of want to.
Yes,
is the answer. I would frame that and put it on my wall.
I've not seen it in a very long time, but it's probably a movie I watched 10 times on television.
So do you remember the teaser for this?
Yes, of course.
The teaser is famous.
Yes.
Because it's just Robin Williams in that weird green field.
The teaser,
just riffing.
The teaser is why Fox greenlit the movie at that budget. Because they were like, well, if you just put this out, it'll work. It doesn't matter. Audiences will go see this.
You should watch the teaser at some point, Emily. I'm sure it's up on YouTube.
Oh, you have.
I remember vividly seeing the teaser and being like, yeah, no, I mean, I'm in.
Robin can sell audiences on anything.
So I was, and then I saw it in the theater in 92.
Yes.
And I remember really liking it.
Yeah.
I bought the soundtrack.
Wow.
Tori Amos.
Yeah. I remember
like
the soundtrack ripping. Yeah.
So it's just, anyway, we're going to do Toys. I can't wait to hear what Emma and Emily have to say about it.
I'll say this. I haven't rewatched it in a long time. I do think it is kind of unquestionably one of the great art direction movies ever made.
Yeah.
If like, especially if you're considering like most art direction.
And it didn't even get nominated.
No, but I think that because it speaks to how much people were angry about that movie.
It did receive a nomination for art direction.
Oh, it did.
It lost to Howard's End.
I was going
to
say, it's kind of undeniable on that level.
Yeah. Yes.
Especially just the scale and the execution of what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, David has given it 2.5 stars on his letterbox, so I guess that David's not a big fan.
Yeah.
But someday I'm very excited for you guys to, whenever it might very well be, to talk about it. But
it's also
fascinating
that movie is the cornerstone of Robin Williams falling out with Disney. Because Aladdin thing.
Yes.
Don't put my name on the poster. Don't sell it on my name.
Yeah.
Don't
because
sell
he
the
was all in on Toys.
And he was like, I don't want you to sabotage Toys.
God bless Robin Williams for wanting toys to
know,
perform.
But he was like, look, if I'm having two movies released in the same calendar year.
It's just a picture here, and there's two guys in a cart, and it says duck crossing.
Correct.
Just look at how insane
this looks. Just wait, because there's little ducks that cross.
Oh, my God. Five stars.
Five stars.
I bet you're imagining, like, organic ducks. No. Wind-up toy ducks.
It is... Yeah, I mean, it's one of those films that, because I feel like when you guys landed on the idea of Blank Check, mm-hmm. right, there's a handful, you're about to cover one of them, Last Action Hero, which I feel like is kind of one of those.
Yeah,
I do love that movie.
You know what I mean?
Like, I basically come around to fully loving that movie.
So it just, it is interesting that, like, I understand the reticence to cover all of Levinson's films. Wholeheartedly, I think it might break David.
But it was curated my year of flop style, which is you just cover
toys would be in the top three, probably or top five.
In the first month of doing that, it's a case where the format of our show kind of plays against it.
100%. I completely understand it, but it is. It is one of those very odd movies. Yes. The fact that it's also kind of a movie that doesn't exist. It's kind of forgotten.
Yes.
You can't even really buy it or watch it.
No. It's his like weird, like anti-war screed.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I gotta see this thing. I'm so glad. I'm gonna make my wife watch it tonight. She's gonna be so mad.
So mad at you. But yeah, it really is a fascinating thing. I watched a little bit of the video game last night on YouTube just out of curiosity. Yeah. And it's the video game that you would expect, except it's you are Robin Williams and you're like pooping out ducks.
Sure.
How have I not seen this?
Final point on this, because I want you to text me after you see the movie with this prompt, okay? Because in that grouping of movies I'm talking about, there are the scenes that were like burned into my memory, scarred me deeply. In Return to Oz, it's the witch with the room full of all the heads, right? In The Wiz, it's weirdly the subway performers with the paper mm-hmm. puppets that get bigger mm-hmm. and bigger and start chasing them. Mm-hmm. There is that kind of weird, it is very cartoonish and stylized, but there is like a sequence of imagery in toys that I would say is not the most extreme thing that is depicted in toys by any measure. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if Phil thinks he knows which one it is. It comes late.
Okay.
That like similarly just deeply upset me as a child, and I still think of it with like great discomfort.
Okay.
I'm curious as to what it is. You can text me. Let me know.
But when you watch the movie, I want to see.
I will.
Yeah.
If you can identify it and if you have the same response.
I will.
We watched something relatively recently that I thought that you really liked and then you just got exhausted by. And I'm trying to remember what that film was. Do you remember what it was?
I'll look it up.
Because I feel like it made me wonder, it wasn't Delicatessen.
It was, I think, Stay Tuned. Stay Tuned just warmed the fuck out.
Yeah, Stay Tuned was the movie that I feel like I was like, I think Emily's going to love this. And then by the end, you're just like, I can't do this anymore. Yes.
It's just too much.
Yeah. But toys, I think, I'm hopeful for toys.
Yeah, I'm hopeful.
Griffin,
too.
Will you tell our listeners about your podcast?
It's called Blank Check with Griffin and David. We haven't done an episode on toys, and there's no toys episode locked in the books.
I had heard that the Levinson miniseries is starting in August, and everyone on the Reddit should, like,
harangue us about it. I genuinely can't remember whether or not we did end up putting him on March Madness, but it was like an intense
vote Levinson. I want to go on and talk about some movie nobody remembers.
Yeah,
I mean, listen, I'm actually a bit of a Levinson stan. Like, I would ride for some of his movies, but he's
still got to go on for the humbling
Jimmy Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, there's
a lot of weird movies in that filmography for
there's
sure.
A lot of weird ones.
And a lot of Baltimore.
You know what?
Did he make it?
I think he made the cut.
Yeah.
So if you want a toys episode,
this is your way.
Go out to the polls. You're in line, stay in line.
So your podcast is Blank Check with Griffin and David. You also have a Patreon, correct?
We do. Yeah. Patreon, we do more franchises, film series, main feed. We do directors who have Blank Check careers, and we cover their whole filmography one film at a time. So we're starting up John McTiernan now. And on Patreon, we're doing the Terminator movies. A perfect. They just totally knew how to sequelize that movie.
They really did. It really. It's just the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes.
This is just a Barry Levinson movie I pulled up at random. The plot involves two Whig salesmen, one Catholic and one Protestant, who live in war-torn Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Emily, this movie was like a pre-Blacklist Blacklist script.
Oh, mm-hmm. God.
Where everyone was like, you can't believe how good this fucking script is. Every reader in Hollywood was doing backflips about it.
It was post-Wag the Dog.
Yes. And it's like early DreamWorks, mm-hmm. and it's like Barry Levinson is the director who won the battle of who gets to make Everlasting Peace, and he's decided to cast two good character actors and not movie stars, and they gave it a prime, like, holiday season Oscar heavyweight.
December 25th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just, like, nothing. Doesn't
no one cared. I do think, and this will be the last thing I say about Barry Levinson, I do think he has an oddly flexible career in the sense that, like, he actually can do a lot of things. He has more range than you would expect.
On paper, that quality makes him a good candidate for a podcast because it's not samey.
Yes.
The problem is you need to remove like 8 movies.
Like, I agree.
It would be interesting if he only made one example of each type of bad movie. Where in fact, like, most mistakes he made 2 or 3 times.
He made a lot of TV.
Types of mistakes.
Yeah. At a certain point, he became like a go-to HBO films guy. He did a lot of those.
Like, his last 8 films were removed and replaced with his last 2 HBO movies,
he'd be
a no-brainer.
Yeah. He really went long. He just kept going. And he's still doing it. Yes. I mean, more power to him, I guess. Griffin, thank you for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely appreciate it.
I was just saying, always great to see you.
Always great to see you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.